This podcast is sponsored by Bombfell. Open and close. Get $25 off your first purchase by visiting bombfell.com/GOT. That's bombfell.com/GOT.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 8, Episode 3, titled The Long Night. Not the Battle of Winterfell, like we all thought it was going to be titled. Just The Long Night.
As Jim Jones thought it would be titled.
I think we all did.
Did we?
Yeah, I think the internet at large, yeah.
Okay.
I speak for the whole internet. And I'm going to continue to do so throughout this podcast. So
it is a curious choice to call it The Long Night, since the previous the other Long Night lasted for like a potentially a generation. This lasted for an eternity in TV time, some 90 minutes, but not generations.
No,
not generations.
No, for sure.
Mothers did not boil their baby. Or what was it? I forget all the scary things that old Nan used to say about how bad. It snowed as deep as the castle walls, and the mothers clutched their dead babes at their chest. And
yeah, Bran still remembers that story.
He does. For sure. He remembers everything.
Yeah,
man, every single death in Westeros. That must. No wonder he's so bummed out.
Well, he doesn't have a whole lot more on his mind at the end of this. Not a ton of deaths.
So we're professional podcasters. I imagine mm-hmm. you watched this show at least one more time. Mm-hmm. What did you think about The Long Night on second, perhaps third watch?
So this is the longest battle, from what I can tell, from what I've been reading. This is the longest battle ever in TV or cinema. Mm-hmm. The longest continuous battle scene. Impressive, mm-hmm. I think, from the outset, just from that one conceit there.
Yeah.
I also think they were able to spend a fair bit of time in that longest battle in cinema history with characters and smaller moments. I like the stuff that was happening with Tyrion and Sansa down in the crypts. I thought there were a couple of good moments between like Theon and Bran. But on second watch, I was not as enthusiastic about it as I was the first time because I started to notice some cracks.
Yeah, I mean,
I wasn't as hyped up.
Right.
And they do a great job of also establishing tension.
Yeah.
From the jump, right from the beginning of the episode, it's as tense as you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And I think that carries through the whole episode.
So my opinion is I think this is just Bravo A+ go for broke execution to a mediocre plot and script. And I think that I'm not one of the ones, because I feel like that there's in the fandom, there's like roughly divided into thirds, although maybe this first third is a little skinnier than the others, is you've got a third of people that just thought it was great, satisfied on all levels, hyped up beyond belief. You got the people in the middle are kind of like, well, you know, I definitely don't think it was complete trash, but I also don't think it was like, you know, exactly what I was expecting. And then you've got the people that like, it's completely failed for them. It's completely fallen flat, and they are like tearing this thing down from like every little plot point. And I'm not in that camp. I'm more of in the middle camp because I just thought this is indicative of Game of Thrones since it's kind of gone off script. Is that I can't remember who said this on one of the subreddits, but they said the Game of Thrones has abandoned like the character based like consequences of actions for like the TV based setup payoff. And I feel like that is kind of indicative in this episode. There's lots of little moments of like things that are set up and then paid off, but it's not the same as like a satisfying conclusion. So like, Arya being the one that slays the Night King kind of works for me just from purely, you know, it's fine. I do wonder when you look at all the prophecies and you look at all the things that were supposed to happen, you look at all the things that they paid off and hinted as far as the Night's King and the others and the White Walkers and their culture, and it is hard not to feel just a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, I wonder how much this disappointment is going to carry over to the end of the series, because I feel like some of the things that Game of Thrones does are disappointing in the moment. Like killing yes. Rob and Catelyn was right. pretty damn disappointing in the moment. Right. You know, there are a lot of moments like that. Beheading Ned was pretty damn disappointing.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we look back at those and say, oh, those things needed to happen. They were actually what made the show unique and interesting. I don't get the same vibe from these kind of episodes, but also the payoffs are coming from long-term plot lines, right? Uh-huh. Like, Arya has spent 8 seasons becoming who she is so she can do this thing. There have been prophecies around her saying she would do this thing.
Sure.
If you look at him, you know, from a certain point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, it's not as satisfying in some ways in the moment to pay off those larger kind of things, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, you can go into an episode, set something up, and pay it off and have everybody cheering.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. But I think Game of Thrones is trying to do both here. And it mostly works in that arena for me. It's other places where it falls apart. Like, I don't agree with you that the execution is A+. I think the execution is like a B, if that.
Huh.
Simply because there are so many things that they do in this episode that leave me scratching my head going, how did that person survive? Or like,
well, but that's script, right? That's like,
no, that's the director's job to communicate like where the action is happening, what danger are our characters in, how did they get out of that danger, like, this is all like that's on the director.
I guess I disagree. Do think, like, because I don't know, like, if it says on the script that, like, Jon narrowly survives a crash landing of his dragon, it lands in a heaping, smoldering wreck on the snowy field of battle, like, the director's got to show that, right? But
sure.
I think, to me, that throughout this whole episode, they were doing things that are telling me that this character is meeting a particular fate.
Mm-hmm.
And then time and time again, that got subverted. Like,
yeah.
Surrounded
by
walkers, no way out, getting stabbed actively, and then they get saved. You know, a dragon getting ripped apart and crashing. I don't think you're supposed to there's a lot of those things where, and then if you look at it from a lower level, not just like the strategy and tactics on the battlefield were
garbo. I don't care so much about that. Like, you know, complaining about the Dothraki charging and like, they weren't set up properly in the first place. I don't care, because I'm not a military strategist, and 99.999% of the people watching aren't either.
Yeah, but like,
if it holds up on screen and makes sense, and actually if it's just cool in some cases, I think it works. I don't need to be like, you know, have the military historians come in and say, but this wouldn't have happened that way.
I agree with the fact that if it's cool enough, it doesn't matter. But I also think it's, you know, military advisors are cheap. They're not the ones that are breaking the budget on these episodes. Like, having a person come and like just say, hey, here's your, this is your battle plan. Well, if you just make these tweaks, it's going to make it more visually exciting. It's going to be clearer. It's the people that do sweat these details and appreciate the details are going to appreciate it even more. I'm not inclined to, I guess, let Game of Thrones off that particular hook, because it just feels like they just don't bother. It's just like, hey, we saw a bunch of this stuff in other movies, because there's a lot of stuff that's cribbed from other movies in here, and we're just going to throw it in because, you know.
The stuff that bothers me more is what takes me out of it as a viewer, or confuses me as a viewer.
Yes.
Like, when I'm looking at an action scene and I literally can't tell what's happening.
Yes.
Because either A, it's extremely muddy, which this episode has a huge problem with,
mm-hmm.
or B, it's shot so close up and so frenetically
mm-hmm.
that I don't understand even the shapes that I'm seeing, let alone how they're interacting with each other. That becomes the larger problem, is when, as a viewer, I can't keep sort of my viewing goggles on.
Right.
I go, oh God, what just happened? Did I miss something? And I felt that way several times through this episode, mostly because it was so fucking dark and muddy.
Yeah, and I was really hedging my bets on the instant take, because, like, you know, this, I know our studio TV is not the greatest. It doesn't handle blacks, but it's also not the worst, honestly. It's it's an LED, not LCD, so it's not like terrible. But like, I went home and got it pitch black, and my viewing room has got a really nice plasma. It's got damn near reference levels of black, and mm-hmm. I've never had a problem with any, even like really dark scenes, because Better Call Saul is really experimenting with like low light level camera work, and honestly paving the way for like just using ambient like street lighting to film at night and make it look gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of them. It's way too fucking dark. There's way too much atmospheric effects. Someone did this pictorial comparison between like the Battle of Helm's Deep and Lord of the Rings, which is takes place on a moonless night. It's in and lots of parts. There's driving rain, and everything is crystal clear. You can see all of the action. You look at here, where like honestly, I had to see some GIFs where the brightness level was 400% and slowed down, so I could even appreciate what was going on in like some of the aerial dragon combat. Yeah. And I guess you're right. If that might be execution, to me, that's like I feel like Miguel shot something that was probably perfectly good, and then the post processing for whatever reason decided to go for this. And I don't think they don't account for the way people watch TV nowadays, because if you're trying to watch this on like a cell phone or a laptop or a tablet, you're gonna have a bad time. And also the fact that like HBO's codecs aren't good enough to handle this on peak times, because
their streaming bitrate isn't high enough. I've read that it's like half of what the Amazon stream was, which apparently people had better luck on Amazon, though still muddy.
Right. It looked like, I think off peak times it looked better, but still like...
Yeah, I thought it looked better on my second viewing, but I was at home literally...
Yeah.
In my basement, no lights on, one screen on. It was the only focus, and I could sort of make out what was happening, but it still felt extremely muddy and hard to see.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what they're going for.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, because they almost nail it so hard that I don't like it.
Right. But I do think that there are... So the praise I'd like to heap on this episode is I think that they did like land some of the epic natures. Like there's a couple shots that I'm just like, holy cow, that's really gorgeous, or that's really terrifying, that's really epic. I thought they nailed the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Like the suspense, say what you will about the Dothraki charge, but like the lights being extinguished one by one, and then just the pittance that came back from that charge, and then the screaming of the whites and the beating of their feet, and the, you know, like seeing all the Unsullied kind of steeling themselves for what's to come, like all that stuff works. And then like I think more of the plot problems started kind of hampering, and there was a lot of stuff where like throughout the middle of the episode, it's like, why are we spending 7 minutes doing some kind of stealth mission through Winterfell? Is there still a battle going on? Like, what is the story purpose that's being served here? And then it gets like, I actually think that, you know, Arya killing the Night King is awesome. I think it would have been much better served if that had been a combined, like Bran was doing something to distract him and Jon was killing his dragon.
He was doing the only thing Bran knows how to do, which is stare.
Right, yeah,
he's been building that stare up for seasons now.
The Care Bear stare.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean, though? I think no one would have a problem if Arya, this was like a Team Stark effort.
Sure, yeah.
Where like Jon, but I think a lot of people are salty, rightfully so, for not having any of the princes or princesses that were promised to doing any kind of 1v1 versus Night King, or when they did do it, it's completely ineffectual. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have a... Like even in this own episode, I feel like they play really fast and loose between what the whites can do and how perceptive they are versus like when they need to be just really stupid.
Yeah, I want to go back to the prince that was promised thing real quick, because this is kind of what I mean when I said earlier, I wonder if the opinion is going to change looking back on this, because that is one of the things that Game of Thrones has definitely done, which is to subvert prophecy.
Yeah.
To say prophecy doesn't actually matter as much as you think it does. So the fact that they don't go there in the final, the climactic battle with the Night King is kind of what they've been telling us all along, I feel.
And
it's going to work out. Like, prophecy's going to work out sometimes because that's just the nature of guesses, right? Uh-huh. And prophecy is not going to work out other times because that's also the nature of guesses, which is essentially what these prophecies are.
Well, I mean, that's one way to view the lens of what's going on. I mean, I also think that, you know, when you have real magic powers and real seeming gifts of divination, that some of these things should pay off more, or else we should have you're right. You can make a narrative case for it, but like it doesn't feel, if you're a fan who's been deeply invested and like really trying to pull apart these breadcrumbs and teasers. And also the other thing,
this is why I say there are moments that are disappointing that we might look back and say, oh, that's no, that's
but those
so other, Game of Thrones.
Those other disappointments were like, they were tied to just like, we as fans wanted our heroes to win and they got vanquished. This, it's the opposite. Like, no one of note that people really cared about, you know. I know you got a little bit of spicy mail for that statement. But like, you know.
But I'm right. Yeah, nobody cares about Jorah.
Like, yeah, I mean, there might be a Tumblr.
I'm kidding. I'm just.
There might be a Tumblr shrine to the Ed out there, but I feel like that everyone won. It was a thrilling episode. No one of note that like we'd really be like, not even like a Sam type of character died. Not even Gilly died. Not even like Lyanna Mormont is probably the one that everyone's the most worked up about. Maybe Jorah. Maybe people are carrying candles for Jorah. But like, this, I think, is just disappointment based on not like we didn't get what we wanted or, oh, we got that and we should have seen it coming. But just like, huh, I thought there would be more. Now, still three episodes. It's entirely possible that the whole thesis of the show is the Night King didn't really matter. The Night King was an existential threat in so much that enough humanity couldn't pull their heads out of their arrogant asses to stop him. But now the true villain is going to be Cersei and the intrigue at the King's Landing and all that. Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard to pull off a super satisfying ending for a lot of people after this.
Yeah.
But I will say, you know, I've been saying all along, like, this is the battle before the battle that I'm really interested
in.
Sure. Which is the battle in King's Landing, potentially. Or it could even be that now, because I think Tyrion and Varys need their moment to shine, right? They're
damn straight.
Stuck in these fucking crypts, just climbing the walls, not able to do a damn thing.
I kept on thinking that was going to build to something. You're right, that there was going to be a moment where they matter.
I think it's just not in that episode. I think it's in a future episode.
Maybe, I hope. Because, like, I mean, I do too.
Yeah.
If they crush these next three episodes and this is just like, well, a minor anticlimactic before the real climax, then I think, you know, pretty much all will be forgiven. But they are really, the stakes for these final, you know, battles are a lot higher because I don't think the fans have, you know, I think like 2/3 of the fan base didn't get what they were wanting. And that's, you know, that's a problem, probably a problem of expectations, but also a problem of I think that Double D's, ever since they ran out of the stuff from Martin, is just like their hearts hasn't been in it. And they're are doing the most expedient thing to get from point A to point B. Razzle dazzle people with spectacle and just hope to get out of this thing. And that sucks.
I don't know that that's entirely unfair.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're ready to move on.
I can sort of see that. We're ready to move on too. We're going to get into this recap. Yeah.
Yes. Let's do it. Hey, before we get to the episode, I want to do some bald move housekeeping. And starting off, we just have 1 week left in the sale. It goes from now until May 7th, and we have all of our annual memberships on sale for 25% off. That's both new and renewing. So if you want to get access to great features such as the Instant Talk version of our podcast that you can actually watch us record live on video and then participate with YouTube's chat to ask us questions and comment on the episode that we just watched on Sunday nights, you need to be a club member. Go to club.baldmove.com where you can sign up and again lock in 25%. And it's not just for new memberships, it's for existing. So if you're an existing club member and you want to lock in these savings, go to club.baldmove.com. Speaking of club features, we just reviewed Avengers Endgame, which was pretty fucking awesome. It's making a ton of money. Everybody's seen it. If you want to hear our take, you can get the spoiler-free version for free. But if you want to hear a spoiler-filled take about all the cool reveals and cameos and what we thought about them, you got to be a club member. Also on Wednesday, the Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy continues to roll on with Reign of Fire. And you may not know this, but this film is the debut role of a certain young man who went on to play King Joffrey to some amount of infamy. So you might want to check that out. Both of these, the Avengers as well as Reign of Fire, is on the Bald Movies feed. You can search for Bald Movies in your favorite podcast app, and please subscribe so you can get all of those as they come out. As I've mentioned before, I wrote some books called godsofthrones.com. Anthony and I want to give a preview chapter away for free, and we're deciding which one to give away, and we're like, you know what, we have no idea what people want. There is a survey. If you go to godsofthrones.com right now at the top of the page, you can click on that. It gives a description of each chapter. You can select which one you want to see a preview, and whoever wins will release that preview. And we're also going to select 5 people randomly from the survey to send a print copy of both books signed by me and Anthony, What a deal. GodsOfThrones.com for that survey. I'll announce the winner next week. Finally, pin-y.com. We are still pre-ordering the House Snow pins, but there's a limited number of slots, and they're all about gone. So if you have been waiting to get a House Snow pin, please go to pin-y.com. All of these links, of course, are in the show notes. And finally, Cecily and I will be co-oping the hell out of Super Mario Brothers World 3D, and we play that on twitch.tv/baldmove. You can catch up. We played through World 1 and 2 last week. You can catch up on twitch.tv/baldmove. Watch us live at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
This is going to be a slightly weird recap. I'm just going to kind of go through the events as they happen because there aren't really scene breaks
right
in this. There are a couple, but I can't just, you know, do this whole episode in half-hour chunks.
Mm-hmm.
So stop me if you really want to talk about something.
Okay.
First of all, they do this great job of creating tension at the beginning where we visit kind of all of our characters or a good portion of them as everyone takes their places for the battle. We could see, you know, Grey Worm gearing up and Tyrion watching Bran go to the Godswood, be brave as he has to go to the crypts and be cowardly. Not really cowardly, but, you know, less than he wants to be in this scene. And I think there's some really good stuff at the beginning of this. So then Melisandre rides up out of nowhere and sets the Dothraki swords on fire. And Davos goes out to meet her, and Melisandre says, "You don't have to kill me because I'll be dead by the dawn." And turns out she's right.
First time she's made a truly accurate prediction.
Yeah, yeah. I think the green eyes of Arya's prophecy still has yet to come true.
Not all the way true.
Yeah, I mean, so
she shut some
that
blue
one
eyes.
Could still fail.
She shut a shit ton of blue eyes.
Yeah.
On Sunday night for sure.
She did. That was pretty badass. I liked seeing Arya kicking some ass. Then we go over to the battle kind of begins where the Dothraki seemingly just get restless or get so hyped up by their flaming swords that they can't contain themselves and run off.
The hilts were getting uncomfortably warm.
That's right.
What are we going to, we're either going to drop these things or we're going to use them, YOLO.
So they charge the army of the dead and they get thoroughly destroyed. And then the army of the dead attacks the remainder of the living forces full on. And Dany and Jon just sort of abandon the plan that they set, the most important part of the plan, and they mount their dragons to join the fight. A huge storm blows in, obscuring the entire battlefield.
I mean, so I said it was a problem that I didn't really understand all of the plan that they're going to do. it just seems beyond okay. It just seems beyond stupid that they intended this to go this way. Do you have a front line of cavalry just going to just charge out? And before they had swords, they were just going to charge out into darkness. There was exactly one volley of like catapult and trebuchet fire. Those trebuchets and catapults, by the way, set up on the front lines, right behind the cavalry.
Yeah, that's silly.
I mean,
probably want those behind the walls.
That's the understatement of the fucking century. That's silly. Why the fuck that would be your second line behind your fucking cavalry, which is already putting the cart before the horse. And then the fact that you've got your two most powerful chess pieces that's just going to provide overwatch, like, I can't believe that Dany was going to sit there and watch tens of thousands of her men that are following her blindly from their far away from their homes and their families just to run in there and die. I mean,
yeah, it seems like she thought she had a much rosier outlook of this whole battle, right? Like, oh, maybe we'll lose a few Dothraki and a few Unsullied, but, you know, the majority of them will be okay, right? And when she sees the reality of it.
I thought that they were going to run out there to, like, probe the night or, like, maybe to get them to run into the teeth of their trap or something.
Yeah,
but no, they just went out there. I don't know. It seems like the way to go would be to let the dead come to you, and when they're engaged in the front, you flank them with those cavalry. That's what, you know.
It's typically, from what I've read, yeah, what cavalry are used for.
I mean, I don't know how many hours of Rome Total War you have to play to or Civilization to kind of like get, or any kind of real-time tactical.
Well, they didn't have those games back then. That's the problem.
I guess so. If this was the only problem of the episode, I wouldn't care, because the Dothraki charging was so beautiful and told the story of how hopeless and overmatched they were going to be so well that, and from such a cinematic perspective that I think this is a wash. Because if everything else in the episode had done its job, nobody would be saying like, oh, Dothraki, oh, the trebuchets, the superior siege engine. It's, you know.
No, and it makes me wonder exactly, really this whole sequence of events in the battle make me wonder how intelligent the Night King is, because I could see a scenario where he is using the weaknesses of these troops against them, right? Like, he knows the Dothraki are prone to just getting excited and bloodlust and stuff like that and just want to get out there and kill. Maybe he uses that to his advantage to sort of wipe them all out in the darkness.
If he had provoked them to doing that somehow, that might have been like a
feather. Yeah, we just don't know, right?
Right.
And like, you know, maybe he's knowing that Dany will kind of see that massacre and be so affected by it that she has to run off too, and he can thereby get to Bran. But all of that is left up for speculation. None of it is really explained, and that's kind of the story of the Night King at this point.
Yes.
None of it is explained.
Right.
Except through a single line from Bran where he says, you know, I'm the memory of Westeros, essentially, and he wants to destroy that.
Yeah. Now, I like that there's, you know, and this is continuing to work for me, even despite these minor problems, because you go and you see, like, the extreme youth and age of some of the fighters, and then we see, like, oh, my God, there's so many of our beloved favorites on the front lines.
Yeah.
Like literally the front, like they're the teeth of this wall, and I'm like, oh wow, like a third of these people are going to die, and then you see the dead actually hit, and like, oh my God, this might be a squad. Like this
how
might
could anyone
be,
survive that?
Like John and Danny are like on their dragons, and Bran's probably everyone that's outside probably is not going to make it back.
Yeah,
like Jesus, and then. By the end of the episode, the incredibly light butcher's bill from a dramatic possibility is just
It
undercuts all that tension. Like, what good is building all that tension if you're not going to have the fortitude to carry through? Like, why are all these people surviving? Like, they better have a very integral part to play for the things that come. They can't possibly. There's like a dozen people. They're going to have like a really fucking crowning moment of like, oh, of course, that's why they were spared. They had to be here. But it's not. It's just
I'm both, you know, disappointed that more important people didn't die, because like you said, they were literally on the front line and they should have been overwhelmed immediately. They should have been some of the first to die. But I'm also glad that they didn't die, because that leaves open the possibility of giving them a more meaningful death, or at least a more meaningful resolution to their story, because dying on that battlefield, There's nothing meaningful about it.
No, but that also, Game of Thrones never used to be afraid to have a person ground up in a meat grinder when they find themselves in a meat grinder. And I feel like they lost their nerve, and I don't know why, because they're so close to the end.
Yeah.
They have to know that some of these people are expendable, so expend them.
Yeah, I feel like at this point, both Jaime and Brienne were expendable.
Right.
Jaime maybe less so because he might have some more interactions with his sister. Sure. But Brienne had just got everything she wanted. Now's the perfect time to kill her from a narrative perspective.
And I don't want to be like, I don't want to sound ghoulish like I had it in for everybody. But like the other thing is, this show used to be very good about not putting characters in situations and not have it logically follow through. And I feel like this episode, there were a couple points where I tried to give a benefit. I was like, okay, this isn't a Walking Dead. You get one bite, one scrape. But you'd have a character just surrounded by whites. Mm-hmm. And time again, like someone would come in and like you'd see a blurry sword swing in and like a bunch of whites would go flying and they'd pick them up. And like that just like not just once or twice, which I think you could get away with. Like if there was an especially heroic endeavor, sacrifice to save somebody, that would work. Maybe the person doing the heroic, like the way they did with Ed, perfect.
Yeah.
All out ditch Jorah effort to get Jorah. Was awesome, Jorah was, you, I think those are the two that they should have done. Everybody else should have died when they get in those situations. Because otherwise, after the third time I saw Brienne screaming covered in whites from head to toe.
Or Sam with the dog pile on
Sam,
top of him.
Or Jaime or Tormund. They were all getting, and they were all also making the stabbing noise, and then you'd see the character scream. I'm like, oh, well, they're gone. But they're not gone.
Yeah.
Like, why put them in that predicament? You guys don't have to do this. You can have them just be superior fighters or...
Yeah, and I think I have a single change that would have fixed most of these problems.
Yeah.
Put the Unsullied kind of up front where they need to be with their phalanx abilities and have everybody sort of behind them. Like, you know, line up Jaime and Brienne on the front lines of their particular, whatever you call a wing of an army. And then the Unsullied can be kind of the protective layer between them and the dead. And you suffer heavy casualties with the Unsullied, but they do their fucking job, and that's heroic for them, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they were born to do. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else doesn't get put in these ridiculous situations. They can fall back behind the Unsullied.
Yeah.
Unlike here, where they had to sort of run around the Unsullied to retreat.
Right. Yeah, there's a whole lot of, like, it is also, I think, kind of says something about Dany that I don't think the filmmakers intend, that she did send her Dothraki and Unsullied out there to bear what was apparently the brunt of the losses. You know, like, yes, you're right. The Unsullied were created to be the unthinking, unfeeling slave army that is there for cannon fodder purposes, but Dany's made them much more than that. So it's now, like, super fucking tragic. It's like, you know, Data, when he dies in one of the Star Treks, right? One of the shitty Star Trek movies, doesn't Data die? Spoilers for a 10-year-old Star Trek The Next Generation
probably
movie.
Like multiple times.
And then his, like, 4-year-old child brother brain took over before. Anyway, okay. Data's a robot, man. There's no intrinsic reason to care about him. So like, you know, let's send Data into to do the dangerous shit. Why not? Because he's expendable, but he's not expendable because you care about him. Well, they made us care about this Unsullied, so they're no longer expendable robots, yet they're still being used as such. I don't know, because I was warring and myself as like, man, respect for their bravery and just their refusal to break in the face of overwhelming odds, and also like, fuck, that's brutal. That's brutal.
Yeah,
and
I was not suggesting that from like a, hey, they're expendable perspective,
but
because
no,
everybody in this battle is expendable.
And I don't think the showrunners did either, but by having all these people suffer just grievous filmed losses and then having all the people we care about be safe, it did feel like that. It felt like that's what was happening, in fact, if not in...
It's setting up a divide between characters you love and characters you don't.
Right, right.
Sure.
Like, you know, just redshirting the entire class of Dothraki and Unsullied.
But I assume Grey Worm makes it?
I think Grey Worm makes it.
Yeah.
Although Grey Worm is one of the many people. There's like a dozen people surrounding by whites should have been dead, and they're not dead.
I do think it means nothing.
There's a shot where like Danny, like so Danny and John, they see the wall of White Walkers at the back of the, because the White Walkers are no fools. They're not on their own front lines.
Yeah. No.
They set up a strafing run, and then like the wall of winter descends. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene of like Danny doing this final strafing run in front of this advancing blizzard, and it looks like, you know that picture of like the Eagle Nebula that Hubble took? It's called the Pillars of Creation. This looks like the exact opposite, like the Pillars of Negation. And it's fucking beautiful. It would be like a painting you'd see hanging in the Louvre if you just took that shot and throw it up there. It's so beautiful.
And it almost makes me want to give them a pass on how shitty this whole episode looks, like how murky and unintelligible everything looks, because they kind of follow the logic of it to the detriment of the episode, right? Like the Night King, we know, kind of travels with this wintry force, and if he can obscure the battlefield
and
use, you know, kind of create his own home turf here, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And they run with that in the episode. Unfortunately, it also has the side effect of making it look like trash.
No, you have to. And then again, look, I'm not faulting their artistic decision to go with a very dark, smoke-filled, shrouded battlefield. Mm-hmm. It's just, if you can't film that in a way that anyone can see what's going on, or unless that's the point, because I remember there was a point in like season one of Fargo where there's a whiteout blizzard scene that lasted a couple minutes long, but it was like not a whole episode where like 50 people are moving around in there and people are living and people are dying. Like, it's, if you don't have the technology to pull that off, then, you know, cause like all you need to believe that their vision is hindering is have like, you know, the characters like shielding their eyes and squinting and, you know, like show a POV where they can't see like 6 feet in front of head. But when then just establish that that's happening, and then you don't have to film it like that the rest of the time.
Yeah. I'm with you.
But and then that, like with the codec and with people's viewing devices being what they are, it just led to a perfect storm of what the hell's going on.
So then we move to Arya sending Sansa to the crypt and joining in the fight. And I think this is where Sansa realizes, oh, yeah, we got to look the truth in the face. I need to not be here on the wall ready to be killed. And Dolores Ed gets killed saving Sam. Dolores. I never know how to say that.
Dolores, I think. Dolores? That's the word? I don't know either.
But yeah, he gets it right through the back of the head, right through his eye.
Yeah, just got skewered. He's the first big name casualty of the Long Night, I do believe.
He is, yeah. And he, I feel like he had served his purpose in the story. I think it being down to kind of the last two brothers of the Night's Watch is a good thing at this point.
Sure.
And honestly, it probably should have been down to the last brother of the Night's Watch and the rightful heir to the throne, Jon Snow, based on what I saw this episode, but it's not.
Yeah.
So then Tyrion can tell by the look on Sansa's face that the battle isn't going well when she comes down to the crypts.
It's actually kind of hilarious that they decide, like, what a morale breaker. Mm-hmm. That like, well, the Lady of Winterfell's here, we're set. no, she's going to hide in the very back parts. And like Tyrion's preparation for this battle was to grab two large wineskins. And he just chugs.
That's so Tyrion.
Well, it is so Tyrion, but that's part of like, fuck, Tyrion needs to stop being Tyrion. And what I mean by that is Tyrion, he needs to sober up. He needs to lay off the eunuch jokes. He needs to fucking find a way to contribute. Because, like, this is, like, old Tyrion. Doesn't know what to do, so I'm just going to get blind fucking rip-roaring drunk. I don't know. I felt like him giving into his worst impulses is not what I was looking for him out of Season 8 Tyrion.
But I think Tyrion has not been the same, obviously, since he killed his father, right?
Sure.
And that whole betrayal and everything about that.
What's that? That sent him on a character path.
But I feel like Tyrion was doing his best work right before that, when he was drunk most of the time. Like, he was making very good decisions about a lot of different things. I don't know that drunk Tyrion is a bad Tyrion, necessarily.
drunk, inept, ineffectual Tyrion.
Sure.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like,
that's what you don't want to see.
And I also think that, like, again, I'm thinking of like lazy ways you could tell the story of Tyrion, like him sobering up and you know, using his big uninebriated brain to come up with like a strategy that's going to save lives is how I expected him to behave. Like, you heard me in the last podcast. I'm like, wow, I really hope that they have something for Tyrion Varys to do in the crypts, or that's going to be really lame. Like, Jesus, what's been the point of Varys for these last three seasons? And
I think we're still going to see it. We're just waiting an episode or two more.
I hope so.
Because what would Tyrion have done if he was out there?
I mean, I don't know.
Shout at the Dothraki as they charge into the dark. Don't go.
I mean,
you idiots.
Perhaps. But, you know, he also, like, he's thinking of this from the Battle of Blackwater, where he could actually see what the fuck was going on up on the
parapets. Well, he wouldn't have been able to see anything anyway.
He couldn't see anything. So, like, yeah. The way they shot it, I think it's, you know, there's not much for him to do. But again, that feels like a creative failure.
I think they're just saving him.
All right. We got three episodes left. They're saving Tyrion and the direwolf budget. I'm sure.
They sure are.
I'm sure neither will be disappointed on neither front.
So we move on to Danny and John crashing into each other in midair.
Look.
This is both hilarious and incredibly stupid at the same time. Like, I loved it and I hated it both at the same time.
I mean, all you have to do to make this not be stupid is have them engage in a near miss. Like, that sells you the fact that, like, they don't can't see anything up there. But having these dragons slam, like, or slam into each other, like, slightly oblique angles.
Okay.
But, like, a head-on fucking collision, these things are going what? What do you think they're going, 60 miles an hour?
At least.
And John and Danny are hanging on by these fucking fleshy horns.
I know, man.
What the fuck?
Which is partially why I love it, because it's so stupid. I felt like this was the one moment of comedy in this entire episode that they were going for.
It's not intentional at all.
You don't think so?
No, it can't be. It can't
Maybe
be.
I'm giving too much benefit of the doubt, but I don't know. I thought it was hilarious. On second watch, I laughed out loud when it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also incredibly dumb.
Yeah.
But it's also like, this, again, is them sort of following it to its logical conclusion, right? They're flying these dragons around. They can't see a damn thing. They just happen to crash into each other. That's what happened, you know?
I mean, you can tell that story. It's just, I can judge it as kind of dumb. It's very unlikely. It makes the characters look just not heroic.
That's totally true. Which might be why I like it. But it does feel out of place in this episode. So then the living execute a coordinated retreat inside the walls of Winterfell with the Unsullied providing cover. We kind of talked about this.
No,
but
I thought that was really good, but a minor complaint is that, like, the order is given to fall back. I don't know if this is part of the plan. I don't know if it's because they're just taking way heavier than... Is this, like, the right timing? Is it, like, too early? Was it expected? Like,
I think it is expected that they will do this because they have the trench plan, right?
Right. But it also seemed like the dead's assault was way more ferocious and effective than they thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that John and Danny got in there and started torching things, even though that wasn't the plan... I don't know. Like I said, I wish I had a better way to score how things are doing, how many people are left alive, what was the, you know, how do I know if they're doing better or worse, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think you're right in saying, you know, the episode doesn't really tell us much about that, and they didn't set it up in the previous episode, so clearly they don't care that much about it. So, like I said, with this trench thing, Davos gives a signal to light him up, but no one can see him. So instead, everybody kind of looks around for a while, just saying, who's going to light these trenches? The Unsullied run in, try and light the trenches. Grey Worm is just kind of looking on. Melisandre comes up.
Yeah.
And she uses her magic barely in time to light them up. And you can see on her face that her own faith in her magic is waning at that point. And I kind of like that moment.
Yeah, it's okay.
Where she's still, after all of this, not entirely sure that she can do what she needs to do here.
Or that she'll have the Lord of Light's backing, or that she's going to do it right, or this is the right thing to be doing.
Right.
And there are just some weird things. Like, they spend a lot of time on Grey Worm, and I think you're supposed to understand he's agonizing over when he pulls that bridge, because once he does, he's dooming all the Unsullied to death. But then he does it, and there's no moment. There's no like swelling, sorrowful music as you see the Unsullied.
Yeah.
Like, and also you just see a shit ton of Unsullied still. Also, like, then you see him, like, looking at, like, the torches and the people picking him up, and, like, he's looking back and forth in the trench to, like, these firebrands, and I think they're telling the story of a man who's about to do something crazy to save everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But then the very next scene is the Unsullied forming a box around Melisandre and, like, taking her out there, and I'm like, well, if the problem was the undead were picking people off one by one when they're running up with torches, like, why do you need the Red Woman to do this? And why also were they telling all this story of what's going on in Grey Worm's mind and he's stealing himself and then none of that paid off?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very curious.
Also, why do you have to light these trenches from the front gate? Couldn't you do it from the backside of Winterfell?
Well, like, the plan was to have Dany swoop in and like, as a trap, set the breathe the fire, but, like, there was no backup.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what if Night King speared her? Like, there wasn't
any,
like,
she was out of the game at that point.
Yeah, like, well, that's a very complicated plan that the dragon's going to that's going to fly in from, like, a mile and a half away and light the trench.
Well, they also expected her to be at the Godswood, right?
Yeah.
Or up on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember exactly where they were, but
right. They
were supposed to have their eye on Winterfell at all times.
Yeah.
And so when Davos waves these torches,
they
come in from safety. But
yeah,
I don't know. Didn't work out that way. Let me say, when the trench goes up in flames, mm-hmm. and Melisandre lights it.
This has our first kind of a breathing moment of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly beautiful shot.
Yes.
These flames igniting around Winterfell, lighting up the entire landscape. It's awe-inspiring.
Yeah. And that's why I said the execution is A+, because, like, if you looked at any of the many, many behind-the-scenes footage, like, the care that they took to dress this battlefield and to make everything, like, functional, and then they had to swap everything out, the inflammable stuff, so they can run the gas lines. Like, and they filmed for, like, 3 months nonstop in the dark, in the cold.
Yeah.
Like, -20 degrees, and they're running around here. Like, everyone tried their damnedest to give us a really good episode, and I think that those people that toiled like that should be applauded for the attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, there's, like, that eerie scene where the dead are just standing there looking at the wall of fire, and the living is, you know, looking back at them is really good. If everything was working in the episode, that you're like, this is like you get your first breath of air and, like, oh my God, what's going to happen now?
Yeah. And then it just relentlessly begins again.
But also
the climbing of the walls.
This is also the, like, the hound that what sends him scurrying, you know, into his little hole is because, like, he's surrounded by fire. The dead's on the other side. Like, you know, they got a moment of spite, but he sees where this is going and he's not wanting any of it.
You know who does want some of it? Tyrion.
That's right.
He's down in the crypts. He is really, really wanting to do more to help, but Sansa tells him they can't. Actually, the most important thing they can do, the best thing they can do right now, the most heroic, is to just look truth in the face.
That they can't do anything.
Yep.
That's so weird. It seems like an antithesis of the point that was made previously about the smallest man can cast the biggest shadow. Like, I get it. Like, there's some points where, like, you got to understand your limitations but I mean,
this is not Tyrion's arena.
No.
Battle is not what he is best at. And I think Dany makes that point last episode.
But I also think that people aren't listening to him enough when he's like, yeah, that might be true, but I actually was, you know, if it wasn't for me, King's Landing would have been lost.
Yeah. You still lost it. you held out long enough for your father to come save the day.
Right, yeah.
It's not like he, miraculously won some battle.
That's what we call a military victory.
No, that's what you call the Deus Ex Machina, because he had no idea his dad was going to show up at that point. He just got lucky.
Possibly. I mean, yeah, with the Tyrells for sure. But I mean, I just felt like that was a good point that the episode didn't really have a great answer to. That, like, you know, Tyrion, yes, he's not a fighter, but he's certainly a military commander. And you know, maybe it's like, well, they clearly didn't expect the fact that Night King was going to shroud the whole battlefield in, like, a blizzard, although... Yeah.
Probably should've.
That's something he's done. It's something he's done before. So
maybe they got cocky as Northerners. Like, oh, we can handle
right.
the blizzard.
Oh, snow. Oh, his power is snow.
That's our thing.
Yeah.
So Theon in Godswood tries to express his regret for not doing better with his life. But Bran says he did everything he needed to do. And then he wargs the fuck out of there into some ravens to, I guess, just sort of follow the Night King, see the battle as it's happening.
I mean, I got excited when he started warging because I'm like, yeah. Jesus, the sky's the limit here. He could, like, wrest control of the Night King's dragon. He could, like, inhabit, what if he wargs into Nymeria and leads this giant wolf pack back to, like, you know, save somebody or fight? Like, yeah, there's so many things that could happen. I honestly don't know what the fuck that they were thinking. Like, why was Bran warged for that entire fight? It can't be just to keep an eye on the Night King with the Blackbirds because that information did not help anybody.
No,
Bran didn't relay it to anybody.
No.
Was it like, did he have, like, and again, if they did a better job of explaining, like, Bran has to maintain a warg state with this Weirwood because that acts as a psychic beacon to the Night King and he's irresistibly drawn, like, something.
Sure.
Tell me why this man, this boy is doing this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I'm just waiting for the other fucking awesome shoe to drop and it's never gonna.
Well, one of the best suggestions I saw on Reddit, and I apologize, I can't give you credit because I don't remember your name. I read a lot of shit.
Right.
One of the best suggestions I saw is that Bran could have been warging into, like, whites and kind of deflecting them, keeping them away from our main characters,
sure.
which kind of solves both problems
yes.
of not knowing what the fuck Bran is warging for
yes.
and also all these main characters living.
Yeah.
He could have been, you know, directing that chaos.
Or could have been psychically attacking the Night King. Like, every time the Night King almost has, like, an upper hand on the battle and is, like, command, like, Bran comes in there to give him, like, a psychic wet willy or something.
Peck his eye, yeah.
Or have the fucking ravens carrying bits of dragon glass in their claws and just raking through.
He probably could have prevented that mid-air collision.
I think the problem is there's not a single person on this planet that's not involved in the production of Game of Thrones that can tell you what the fuck Bran was doing.
Yeah.
Like, what? Like,
people,
I know what he's doing.
Have ideas.
He was warging into crows, but, like, of what benefit was that? Why did he do it? Why did he have to do
what
it? Why did he stop doing it at the end? No one can tell you that because that evidence is nowhere on screen.
I agree.
In any of the previous episodes nor this one.
So the dead breached the firewall trenches and managed to climb over the walls and into Winterfell, where the fight gets extra nasty.
I don't know why this worked as well as it did.
It, like, shouldn't have.
These whites have been shown to be just, like, instantly flammable. Like, that's their weakness. So I believe that, I guess, like, enough of their bodies could have, like, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's,
you,
like,
throw enough at it, I think it would work.
Yeah, like, or, but it's kind of like, oh, well, you know what? We're going to put out this brush fire by beating it with gasoline-soaked rags. Like, that's not going to work. So I mean.
And I think this was a moment where they could have maybe taking a step back, give it some breathing room, have some moments with our important heroes, where, you know, they just say, "Wow, fuck, that was crazy, huh?"
Mm-hmm.
Get ready for more of it. But they didn't. They just kind of plow right through this trench.
Make the White Walkers advance to the front lines a little, because we know that they have the power to kind of extinguish flames and, like, create this themselves. They we've seen them, like,
a risky maneuver, but maybe necessary.
We've seen them dragons out of ponds with big chains. They're capable of, like, so what if they built, like, some big siege work that they dropped in and that, like, anything, but, like, I felt like this is the laziest thing that kind of violated their in-universe rules. And like I said, I saw us going, I'm like, okay, whatever. This isn't the thing that, like, killed the episode for me, but it's one of the many things that kind of death by a thousand paper cuts did.
Also, they've got all this dragon glass up on the wall on these Merlins. Why not put it between them as well?
Yeah.
Like, all of this is wall, and you see what happens when any part of that wall breaks. They just flood through that crack.
Right.
Maybe you should have put dragon glass on all of it.
They didn't have enough.
Well, they didn't tell that story either.
Right.
Being like, completely out of dragon glass.
Yeah, the only status of how much they had was Gendry's one thing. It's like, be careful that it's precious. We need all that we can get. Okay.
Anyway, Jon sees the Night King. The Hound freaks out and Arya kicks ass. I really loved the scene with Arya. Just finally seeing her in her element here. And you kind of get the impression that Arya can just fight her way through this no problem.
Yeah.
Which, you know, by the time the episode kicks into the next gear, we see is not actually true, which I think works pretty well. But here in this moment, you're like, fuck, yeah, Arya.
Yeah, until she gets her bell rung, she's almost invincible.
Yeah.
And I really liked that. I like all the, you know, I saw some behind the scenes footage of her and Gwendolyn Christie practicing like their different fights and her night flips and stuff. And she clearly has worked her ass off and, you know, done a lot of stunt coordination, and all their stuff looked really cool. And also, all these mass scenes of men and zombies does not look CG at all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I remember when Lord of the Rings came out that like the Weta massive technology was like this, so they could simulate crowds, was like good for the day. But like if you ever go back and watch the Lord of the Rings, you know, we're more than a decade past them now. And like you can start to see like, oh, I can see this is procedurally generated. This shit like just looks crazy good. Like the Dothrakis, like there probably wasn't more than a dozen of those guys riding horses and are able to duplicate them and make them all look cool. And the zombies pouring, like I compare like what like World War Z looked like. Very similar effect to this, and it's so much more convincing.
Yeah.
It was really good. They had classic The Walking Dead style zombie waterfalls where they're just like pouring over parapets and landing on them and getting back up. All that stuff was really cool. Unfortunately, just interspersed with like Jamie, Brian, Pod, Sam getting overrun with zombies and screaming, and I was just constantly thinking they're dying. Oh, this is the part they're dying. This is the part, and that never happened.
Right. So then Beric kind of kicks the Hound in his ass and says, basically shames him into getting back into the fight. Where he points out Arya on a rooftop and says, "She's not giving up, are you?" Mm-hmm. And they take off after her.
That also, that nifty rolling move she did where there's like a whole corridor, like a whole stairway full of whites, and she like rolled over all their backs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That super was really cool. Another cool scene, Lyanna Mormont kills a giant and dies in the process.
Yeah.
Man. So I'm, you know, if you've been listening to this for a few years, this podcast for a few years, you know, I didn't like my initial meeting with Lyanna Mormont.
Right.
But this scene, got to give it to her.
Yeah. I mean, this is great. Like, honestly, two or three more people die with this kind of, like, hero's death, and I think the episode has a lot, like people are taking a lot more seriously.
Yeah.
But, like, like this and Jorah, but they just needed a couple more of them. Because here's the thing, is, like, I feel like that there are people that, like, are even shitting on this. Like, oh, what's the giant doing? He's going to bite her head off. He's going to do, like, okay, you're only saying that because nothing is working for you, so you're just shitting on everything.
Yeah, you're nitpicking at this point.
Yeah, like, why did the dragon, like, try to rear up on Jon for it? Because they're just, you know, like, it's cool.
That's what it decided to do.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, brainless giant white isn't, you know, he's just acting on instinct. He's wanting to bite this kid's head off. Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's like going into a sword fight and critiquing their technique in hindsight. Like, oh, if he had slashed left here instead of right, he would have won. Well, fuck off.
Right. Right. The point is, this little girl is like making this doomed noble sacrifice, and she's getting a moment of badass. Like,
and it works.
Probably the end of her line here, but she played her part in protecting the realms of men.
What do you mean, probably? She's definitely...
No, I just say I don't know if there's some, like, cousin of the Mormons that are still...
Oh, the end of her... Okay, her house.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So the dragons battle in the sky, or at least I think that's what happened, because it's very dark, it's very muddy. A lot of winter, a lot of smoke.
Right. You know, there's... Yeah, and like I saw someone on Reddit had taken these scenes and brightened them up and slowed them down so I could appreciate them. But you're right, when you're seeing this in full speed, like on a even decent TV and in optimal viewing conditions. Also, they're just like this. I lost track of how many times the Night King breathed blue fire up Dany's ass, and I don't even know, like, is that shit hot? Does it burn? Like, it seems like it can come within inches of your skin and, in fact, be licking through your hair and all that. And maybe Targaryens are fireproof in this version of Game of Thrones. But are they blue magic fireproof?
I don't know.
It's a little bit, you know, and it's like, look, there's movies that do this. Like, no one's complaining in Arnold Schwarzenegger's Commando that a billion rounds of ammunition are shot. He's standing right there in the middle of it, and none of his bullets miss. All theirs do.
It's not the point.
This is not fucking Commando, though, right?
Sure, yeah.
So,
it would be different if Commando was shot completely in black and with a winter storm and, yeah. and ash clouding the sky. Like, yeah. the problem here is twofold. A, it's murky. Mm-hmm. But B, and more egregiously, because it's not even to a point, really, mm-hmm. Unlike the ash and winter stuff, it's shot too close. Mm. The close-ups are too frenetic. You can't actually get a good frame of reference for what's going on here. Mm-hmm. They needed to pull back, and I think... Look, Miguel Sapochnik has done some amazing work. I think there's some amazing work he does in this episode.
Yes.
But I think the choice to shoot stuff so freaking close mm-hmm. is a bad one.
Yeah.
Just my opinion.
All though. Of his other previous work has been done, and the good work has been done in the daylight, too.
Yeah, that's fair, yeah. I actually feel like this battle is more akin, because everybody's talking about, like, oh, is this, you know, like, Hardhome? They're comparing it to Hardhome, Battle of the Bastards. Mm-hmm. I think this is more akin to the Battle at the Wall, with the free folk. Like where they kind of sneak in. They kind of sneak into Castle Black and, mm-hmm. and, you know, the whole thing with Ygritte dying and everything. Right. I feel like that battle feels more like this
one. It's nighttime, is in a frozen environment. Sure, I can see where you think that.
Especially once they breach the walls, then it feels like that times 10.
Yeah, but it's just, this dragon fight, it just feels like they have an addiction to these close calls where, like, everyone's got to be in more, like, to me, I think it's more thrilling if they're doing, like, passes at each other and they're just, like, Danny's pulling off some sick acrobatics on the back of Drogon. Like, and the other thing is, I never felt like Danny nor Jon are actually steering these dragons.
Okay, yeah.
Like, it seems like the dragons are just instinctively reacting and the humans are almost no help at all of, like, oh, I see something happening behind us, you know, like, I'll pull on Drogon's horns so he can wheel around and deal this. So, like, you know, like, the fireball's hissing past people's heads, but, like, just gouts of flame the last 15 seconds that are perpetually licking at the hems of Danny's dress for that entire time, that's, like, you get pretty inured to that pretty quick. It's like, you know, there's no, like, edge at your seat. You can only be on the edge of your seat for so long, and it's like, well, I guess this is like him holding a magical fire dryer or a hair dryer to her, because it's not doing anything.
You get that close enough, though, it'll burn you.
Maybe.
To your point about kind of the dragons controlling the action here, you can see the Night King is like with his spear trying mm-hmm. to get a shot the whole mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. He's clearly not in control either.
Right.
And eventually just falls.
Which begs the question, if they're not going to be in control of these dragons,
why be on him?
Why be? Yeah. Like, do you have to command Drogon to Dracarys or he won't do it?
Right.
So, like I said, I think this is a mistake. They should have had saddles, because then if you had saddles and they're chained in, maybe you can do a mid-air collision and it doesn't seem ridiculous, et cetera.
Yeah. We got to get moving. This is we're an hour in here.
Right.
And we're
the barely
20
minutes in the
episode.
Most of the complaints
episode.
Are the same throughout, so, like,
that's
we can
true,
start
yeah.
fast-forwarding through.
All right, I think you're going to complain about this one. I don't think this is a scene to complain about, but Arya gets chased into the library by the dead, where she plays hide-and-seek for a while before the chase resumes. You don't like this scene, right?
I think this... I know why they did this, because they thought that this would pace things. Like, this is going to mm-hmm. give people a different type of tension. The problem is, like, is there a battle raging outside? How many zombies are in Winterfell? Why are they so passive and sneaky here? Why aren't they just running through room to room shrieking?
Yeah.
You know, and then this is like a 6-minute long scene, and I just started thinking, like, you know, what's going on outside? It felt like I was watching my kid sister play Splinter Cell.
Okay.
And
I was definitely thinking Sam Fisher.
And I'm like, also, like, could you rotate the camera so I can see the whole room? Can we get an idea what's going on? Like, oh, fuck, just give me the controller. it felt very tedious to me. It felt like it went on way too long as well. And then
perhaps.
She meets up with the Hound and Beric, and there's even more sneaking around for another 2 or 3 minutes. Like I said, I understand why they did it. It's not an invalid creative decision. It's just you had me impatient to get back to, like, the real action.
I think that's fair. But I do think there's a second portion to the reasoning for doing this, which mm-hmm. is to kind of remind us that Arya is this stealth assassin mm-hmm. And that she's very good at hiding. She's very good at right. sneaking, because they're going to need that info
These
later in the episode.
Can hear a drop of blood hitting the pavement, uh-huh. but they can't hear Arya vault over a table 6 inches above their head.
No, I mean, they're definitely going
you're right.
for that, because they have to remind you of that before she sneaks up on the Night King.
Yeah. Although I think, do they? Like, I don't think the people need to be reminded Arya is a fucking spectral ninja assassin.
I think more people would have been dissatisfied if they had not done this scene.
Really?
With
okay.
the ending. Yeah.
It's possible. To me, it sounds as crazy as having to remind people of Tyrion is like really smart before he does something smart.
Uh-huh.
You know, like we need to see, hey, if I don't see Tyrion completing a Westerosi crossword puzzle in 15 minutes before he comes up with his next big idea, then I'm going to come right to the forums and call bullshit. Because how did I know he was smart? Even though that's a defining trait of his character, low these many years. I mean, Arya's been like, yeah. Anyway, let's wait until, because I want to defend Arya as the killer eventually.
Okay. So the fight arrives at the door of the crypts, but soon dies down. We just get a scene of Sansa looking worriedly up the stairs.
That's a good scene. I like that. That shows like it really amps up the stakes for the people in the crypt. Like, hey, if you didn't know already, this battle is not going in your favor. People are dying screaming just on the other side of that door.
So the Hound and Beric save Arya, but it costs Beric his final life.
Yep.
Melisandre reminds Arya about the blue eyes part of her prophecy, and Arya just kind of takes off.
Mm-hmm.
I really love, after Arya takes a castle to the face, I love her look. Like this blood-streaked one side of her face makes her look very scary.
Feral, yeah.
Yeah. It really worked for me.
Also, like, the idea that, like, Beric's purpose, the Lord of the Light saved him for, is to be there to save Arya, the person who's going to be the Kingslayer, I thought is kind of cool. Yeah. And I think they didn't make enough of it. I don't know. Maybe their instinct's right to not to make a meal of it. But I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So Theon and his archers fend off the dead with fire arrows and kind of... it's sort of a preliminary attack, which is a prelude to the Night King walking in, but we'll get there. The dragons battle in the sky again. Rhaegal's injured, which grounds Jon, while Drogon takes a bite out of Viserion's neck, which also grounds the Night King.
I fucking love that. Like, Drogon comes in here, like, listen here, you little shit. Grabs him by his neck, like, after Rhaegal bit
big
half
brothers
his...
here.
Did you see the brightened up, slowed down version?
I didn't.
Because there's some really awesome CGI work. Like, Viserion gets his face ripped off in this scene.
Yeah.
Jon, like, there's a scene where, like, as Viserion is desperately trying to snap at Jon, he, like, grabs his cloak and tears the cloak off of Jon, which you cannot see any of that stuff at full speed and bright lighting. But, like, they're doing all this, like, really cool, you know, like, that's how you do a near miss. Like, he snaps, he misses, he snaps, he grabs his cloak, and he's about to do it. And then Rhaegal comes and bites half of his face off, and he starts leaking blue flame, and that's really cool. And then as the Night King is trying to get this, like, this scene fucking works. They did everything right. And then the Night King gets ganged up on because he's got no allies, and and John's got someone that gives a shit about him. So it works on a storytelling and a emotional level, and it's really damn cool if you can see it, if you can get it slowed down and brightened up about 400%.
So then
also Rhaegal. Okay, I looked, because the other thing is I thought that Rhaegal was getting his guts ripped out the entire thing. After I saw the Brighton scene, the first round of, like, gut ripping is Rhaegal ripping up Viserion. And then Viserion turns to favor later on. So, like...
I saw a big, big bloody gash.
Yeah, but it happens twice. The first time it's to the undead, when the second time it's to the live dragon. But at any point, the dragon just crashes into the ground, like... I feel in the language of cinema that's saying that dragon is, like, very, very injured, maybe even mortally so.
Yeah, I feel like Jon was Sully guiding the plane in to Hudson River.
Isn't it weird that we didn't, like, to me, okay, if the dragon's dead, that should have been a moment. If the dragon's not dead, there should have been a moment of, like, you know, like, you can tell the dragon's injured, but it's, like, still game. It's, like, engaging right away, like, whites and stuff like that. But, like, they don't, like, why have the dragon crash and then leave his fate ambiguous? Like, it's a weird attempted cliffhanger.
It does leave us questioning what the fate of it is.
I think he's going to be fine.
I do, too.
Yeah.
So, Dany blasts the Night King with fire, but it has no effect. It does have one effect. We get the Night King smiling. Riley.
He looked very much like NoHo Hank from Barry when he smiled like that.
Huh, maybe.
Like, you put horns on NoHo and he looks just like him.
Then Jon pursues the Night King on foot, but the Night King raises the dead, blocking Jon's path. the White Walkers and the Night King enter the walls of Winterfell.
I thought this was a great moment too,
yeah,
because like at, you know,
so much tension.
Because you in real time, because you think the Night King, he hears and he's going to turn around, he's going to 1v1 Jon.
Yes.
Then he starts raising his hands, like you realize with Jon that, oh, he's about to raise all the dead. And then Jon does.
This is your only chance.
Jon does what you expect,
yes,
the hero to do. Like, fuck, I might not get it. I'm going to like last ditch desperation, try to get him. And he almost gets there before the sheer mass of the dead stop him.
Yeah.
That I awesome. Thought was really great. Now, still think I wish Jon could get a chance to 1v1 this guy, but
yeah, well, too late now.
What are you gonna do?
So the Crypts are alive with the sound of dead Starks,
mm-hmm,
meaning the Starks come alive in the Crypts, mm-hmm, start attacking the defenseless living there.
Surprised at how much of a rampage this was. Like they're just,
yeah, how many,
like,
Starks come back?
I don't
was
know.
Was it just like one or two?
It seemed like, I mean, why would it just be one or two?
Yeah, that's a fair question.
I'm just saying that, like, I felt
the
like
freshest.
How many living people died, what, you know, just by looking at the bodies, looking at the people covered in blood. Like,
yeah,
this was a real resistance that would have, the Night King would have just won had it not been for Bran.
Yep.
Or, I guess, Arya.
Who knows? Bran might have been controlling the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Jon is saved by Dany, but Drogon gets swarmed by the dead, and Dany falls off as he flies away, and Jorah comes to her aid.
This is just fucking stupid.
This is.
I mean, Dany, I could get it. She's Twitter paid with Jon. She wants to watch him dash off to the castle, but, like, damn. Like, also, like, do you literally have to tell Drogon to do every little thing when she's on his back? Because,
yeah,
like, Drogon gets half overwhelmed by whites before he even starts to defend himself.
I wonder if this is, like, a human being with some ants on them, like ants on on their jeans or something.
Like
they just don't notice it.
Maybe
until they really notice it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I felt like this would be like if you're not allergic to them, but there's like 100 hornets, you know, stabbing you. Like it
oh,
would.
Jesus.
Like it's not a mortal threat, but like it's super uncomfortable.
Huh. Were they stabbing Drogon?
Seemed like
if
they
were
making,
then that makes
they were
yeah,
making I felt like I saw them and they were making the kind of squelching stabbing sound.
Okay.
And Drogon was kind of like screaming like they were, so
yeah.
But I mean, the thing that this happens solely because they need to get Dany off the back of Drogon because she's all but invincible when she's on there, especially now the Night King's lost control of his dragon.
Yeah.
So they need to do this, so Drogon has to be overwhelmed, Dany has to not be paying attention.
And Drogon dealt with the threat eventually,
yeah,
because we see him at the end of the episode. But
yeah, and
he never comes back to the battle at all, does he?
Well, I mean, he might
does
be
he not have
there.
Time?
I don't know. Like, these are some things that should have been worked out at, like, when they're breaking the script, I feel like. Because
yeah.
I love the scene of, like, Drogon going to the air and, like, shaking all these off. And I knew he was going to be okay. And I loved, from Dany's POV, seeing, like, this rain of whites hitting the ground as he's shaking them off. But...
And then getting back up and chasing her.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Jorah has to defend.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we go to Jon having to choose between saving the living or reaching Bran to try and save him and kill the Night King. And he continues on toward Bran.
This desperate
whose
fight,
Ironborn defense is beginning to fail him.
This desperate fight through the wreckage of Winterfell I also thought was really cool and should have
yes.
led up to a heroic moment, but it doesn't.
It does, just not for Jon.
Well,
it leads up to Jon being stymied,
right?
Where there is a heroic moment,
yeah.
Just not from.
Well, okay, let's keep going then.
Not from those particular heroes.
When Viserion crash lands into this thing, and he's like, there's like blue fires dripping from his ruined face, and he's just thrashing around. I thought that was
yeah.
really cool too.
Really awesome. And every time Jon, you know, makes a desperate dash, he's
yeah.
driven back into cover.
Yeah.
He can't make a... He can't gain any yardage.
Yeah, his, like... That's the hardest fight. Like, there's zombies falling from other floors. He's
mm-hmm.
trying to slam porticulluses shut on these things and using his knowledge of Winterfell to try to get ever closer to Godswood. I fully bought this, like, one man doing everything he can in his power and skill to try to get to his brother.
Yeah. And there was... There were a couple of moments in here, like when he looks back at Sam,
yeah,
and then he looks in the other direction at the Night King. I'm like,
yeah.
"Fuck, Jon just made the decision that's going to end Sam's life."
Right.
But they don't follow through.
Right.
Even though Sam is being actively dogpiled, yeah. probably stabbed in every gut he's got.
He's like laying, he's like pulling those whites up to his chin like it's a warm blanket.
Right.
You know?
He's being tucked in.
He's being tucked in to eternal sleep, but someone has set the alarm clock for him, so nope.
So Tyrion and Sansa are hiding in the crypts, believing they're about to die with chaos, with the undead Starks mm-hmm. behind them. And I was really worried for them in this moment, too. And then we go to...
So I don't know if we'll come back to the crypts, but I also think this was a wasted moment to give Sansa and Tyrion a little bit. Like, because they hook up with, like, Varys and the survivors, and it looks like they're taking up a position. They're going to defend this tunnel at all costs. Mm-hmm. But Varys looks at him like he has zero emotion whatsoever. There's no recognition. There's no thankfulness. There's no, like, I thought it would have been cool if, like, when they got to Varys, if Varys had pulled one of the old rusty swords and, like, he was going to defend the kids if nobody else. Like, but none of that. None of that. Mm-hmm. Like, Tyrion and Sansa just get there. They don't do shit. And then next thing you know, the whites are deactivated.
Yeah.
So, like, this moment of them trying to choose, like, a heroic self-sacrifice has no, really no setup and no payoff. It's just weird. It's weird to me.
Okay. So John is blocked by Viserion, which we kind of already talked about. Jorah is stabbed many, many times protecting Dany, but he keeps getting back up to protect her.
He goes super Boromir protecting Hobbit mode.
This worked for me, man.
Yeah, I know. Like,
Jorah's not my favorite character, but...
That's how you give a person a... I mean, it's kind of horseshit how they got him there. I'm not sure even how, like, he fought from the middle of Winterfell to the outskirts of it because he saw... Probably because he saw Dany crashing, maybe, or landing. I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever. He goes out like a hero.
You know he's got one eye on Dany at all times.
Probably. Yeah. Two if he can spare them.
And I absolutely love how he drops dead mm-hmm. as soon as his job is done.
Right. As soon as he knows that Dany's safe.
Yeah.
And the music that starts up in the crypts where Sansa and Tyrion are deciding to, you know, dagger up and roll out. The music that starts, it's very Westworld. but it's also very dramatically appropriate. It felt like a goddamn moment.
Yeah. And it's all happening during the Night King arriving
in
Godwood.
Everyone we care about is literally seconds from death.
Yeah.
Like they pan this and there's like Brienne screaming and Jaime screaming and Tormund screaming. And like you said, Sam's tucked in under his warm blanket of White Walkers. And then we're going to get to the end.
Yeah. The Night King arrives in the Godswood and kills Theon in what I guess is a heroic charge, a heroic last effort
sure.
from Theon. You know, there's a nice moment between him and Bran where Bran just says, you're a good man.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's all Theon needed to hear in life. Yeah. Is that someone appreciates him.
And Theon maybe like, he's probably the biggest death. Him and Jorah, like, because I know that the Ironborn
for me,
after
Theon.
Fans,
yeah.
And he had a pretty satisfying arc that's run low these many years. Mm-hmm. And him kind of dying in his like adoptive home as an adoptive Stark
yes.
is about the best way he could go out other than to surviving and being useful the rest of his life. Like, this is a pretty good moment. I wish it wasn't like this desperate, like, I wish it wasn't like this foolish charge, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he could have tried a little harder to juke to the left or right or something.
Yeah.
And throw the Night King off, but
or wait for him to come to Bran, and you know maybe they do something. I thought when Bran unwarged, because again the first time I watched this I was laboring on the illusion that this was all going to mean something. Mm-hmm. I thought it's like, oh shit, he's going to unwarg, this is going to be something pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I was wondering. I don't know
but I did think that they had given Theon his last moment last episode,
mm-hmm.
his last real moment.
Yeah.
Until they were like, okay, we're going to send Theon out to protect Bran.
Sure.
And then you kind of knew he was going to have at least one more moment.
Mm-hmm.
So just as everything looks completely hopeless, like you mentioned, we're seconds away from losing everyone. Arya jumps in, kills the Night King, destroying every last dead soldier. And you wanted to talk about this.
So a lot of people were incensed that, you know, Arya was the one that kills the Night King. I think that I think the only reason they're upset is because they thought that she was going to do something like wear the face of a White Walker or I saw some people post facto saying that, like, she thought that, like, Bran was going to, just as the Night King stabs him, he's going to, like, roll out of his wheelchair and stab the Night King and then take off his face. And turns out it's actually Arya the whole along. Like, and like, oh, what if, you know, if
the
Arya...
The Night King wouldn't know that? Isn't Bran marked? Like, that wouldn't make much sense.
Well, but what if, like, Bran's, like, hiding behind the wheelchair or something, or he's behind the Godswood okay. or something? So yeah. I don't know. I'm just saying that, like, I feel like Arya has literally been trained by the best killers of everyone that we've met, like starting with mm-hmm. Sirio, going on to Yoren with the Night's Watch, going on to the Hound, going on to Jaqen and, you know, the Faceless Men. Like, she has been, and there was that tie-in of the prophecy. You know, Arya's not ever been like a leading candidate for being the person to kill the Night King, but she's mm-hmm. never been like completely a dark horse, because there is, you know, like, you know, shutting blue eyes, what that makes a lot of sense. And I feel like that they also told the story that there's not much, but there's a moment where, like, the White Walker's hair, like, flies, like something mm-hmm. very fast moved past him, and he yeah. kind of like half turns, like that she is fast and stealthy enough, and she didn't surprise the Night King.
Not
but
totally.
But she got, like, you know, because he's such a gloater, she got the knife drop. I thought that was actually really well done.
Yeah. I did, too. And it takes us back to the battle that her and Brienne fought when right. they first met up again.
There's a couple of emailers that kind of nailed some of the significance that you might miss on the first couple times. Paige said, John was standing in the same spot in the Godswood as the Night King when he said to Arya in the previous episode, "How did you sneak up on me?"
Yeah.
In their reunion scene. So they already established that Arya can, even in this environment, like, move unseen to even someone that's very familiar with this environment. And Alan C. says, Bran gave Arya that dagger last season and said she could use it better than him. He speculates that he saw all this happening, and also it's a very cool detail that this dagger was originally intended to kill Bran, ended up saving him and all of humanity.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of, like, there's a lot of things that make this particular moment, I think, very satisfying.
Yeah.
And they had a great beginning, and I think they had I think everyone had talked themselves into thinking this is a great end. I think there's people like, well, okay, we got to think about the Princess's Promise and some other stuff. Also, this might be a radical opinion. I don't think this season's anything like what George has got in mind.
Like, the more I see, the more I feel you're right.
The more I think that they're almost like, you know, like, they're taking all this shit that should have happened in the books, and instead of paying it off, they're like, fuck it, we're punting. We're just doing our own thing.
Yeah.
Because
it feels more and more like that.
Yeah, I just can't. Well, that's what it feels like to me. So, like, if George so chooses, I think he's going to have a clean slate to do whatever he wants with this.
I mean, at the very least, I feel like George would probably write a more cohesive military strategy.
Well,
a more cohesive defense of Winterfell.
Yeah. So, like, I think the beginning of this episode's really good. The end of this episode, if the middle stuff was better and if people could have actually seen it on the night it was premiered and everyone is super excited for, and this meme of it being like too fucking dark to see and too shaky cam and all that stuff hadn't happened, I think everybody would be having a good episode. But what I see instead is everyone's duly impressed by the spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
But the more they think about it, the more they're like, ah, and then that actually betrays the things that they did right and that was cool. Like Arya, you know, sneaking up and being the one to kill the Night King.
I'm definitely split on this episode. I don't think it's trash. I don't think it's amazing.
No.
I think it's somewhere in the middle.
I think it really sets a lot of pressure for the rest of the season to be very good, or, you know, because it feels like if the last battle between Cersei and everyone kind of is this level of script writing execution and general kind of perceived disappointment, that it's going to kind of change how people think about Game of Thrones.
It could, certainly, yeah. But I think the battle of King's Landing is going to be very different. You know, because I just don't think the North has the forces to clash head to head with Cersei at this point.
So
it's got to be a different type of battle.
Because here's the other thing that I'm afraid of. How many people do you think survived this battle?
Not a lot. Like, all the main characters we care about and maybe a handful of soldiers.
So, like, what if they're being, like, next episode, it's like, oh, we're down to 12,500. We're at a 2-to-1 disadvantage. Are you going to buy that?
I think that's too many.
That's what I'm saying.
In my opinion, I think, like, a few hundred people survived.
That's what I think.
Not even into the thousands.
That's the story I think they were telling, too.
Yeah.
But if that's the case,
I will be disappointed if they have 20,000 troops left, yes.
Yeah, because I don't know how, like, because otherwise, like, how do they win? How do they win? Or but here's the only, I guess,
kind of battle.
The only flaw, I guess, of having Arya sort the Night King's hash is they have to at least try to have her walk in there and murder Cersei, right?
There are a lot of people who could murder Cersei,
but like Arya, like okay. she penetrated the Night King's defenses in like all of his lieutenants and generals and his moment of triumph. Like if she can't sneak into Cersei's bedchambers and ganker,
she certainly would be able to. Yeah. I guess like will she be in a position to before someone else is?
Oh, I see.
Is the question
saying.
I'm asking? Okay, like because okay. Jaime could probably walk right in and say, "I'd like to speak with my sister."
Sure, but do you think that like is it going to be frustrating if they have this like big conventional battle? How to say, I don't know. Like,
yeah,
like
oh, if there are 20,000 troops versus the Golden Company, yeah,
yeah, or 15,000, it's like, oh well, maybe we can beat them because we're better, and they don't. I don't know.
No, I just don't think that many people survived, and I'll be disappointed if they tell me retroactively, yeah, a whole bunch of people survived actually.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, you've got the women and children in the crypts, the people who can't fight very well in the crypts, and you've got a handful of soldiers and our main characters.
Okay.
That's it.
I think that's how I feel, too, but I wouldn't be surprised if they just bald-faced say there's 12,000 people left.
We'll see. You know who we don't have left is Melisandre, because she sees the results of this battle. She walks out the front gate. She takes off her clothes. Of course she fucking does. She's Melisandre, and she drops dead.
Yeah,
as an old woman.
I thought the way they handled her and the hair turning white as she collapsed was perfect, too. It was very beautiful and a great end for her character.
I'm going to give her a little more credit than just say she went and took her clothes off.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened is she shriveled to the point where her clothes just kind of fell off her. Like, she got very old very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The clothes had nowhere to go but down.
Mm-hmm.
And she just sort of lost her clothes rather than stripped her clothes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
It's like a snake molting its skin.
The other thing is, like, I've given Emilia Clarke some shit for not being able to properly display grief. I thought her just losing her shit over Jorah dying was really great, and Drogon then kind of, like, taking her under his wing was a really nice visual, too. And also confirms that at least one of her dragons are intact.
Yes.
Like, Drogon's probably hurt, but, like, he's going to be healthy to play against the forces of the queen.
The other thing that we didn't say when we were talking about how many armies are left... Or how many troops are left.
Right.
At least one dragon, probably two.
Yep, but there's also, like, how many fucking giant crossbows can Qyburn have on the walls of King's Landing? And how can, like, Dany wage an unlimited war against King's Landing? Because that's still a, you know, she can't just, like, fucking roast it. And even now, more so, like, the North has been depopulated, except for the handful of survivors, so, like... You need all of this human capital. This is all, like, everyone's lives are doubly precious that they were 5 minutes ago.
Here's the beauty of it. You can promise everyone a castle afterward. No problem.
That's true.
You get a castle.
Right.
It's like yeah, Oprah. Pod, you can have a castle, too.
And everyone's
why not?
Seats is a keep of your own. You get a castle, and you get a castle.
Just come help me with this battle.
Yeah.
That's the end of the episode.
It is. It is indeed.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before we get to feedback, just want to mention that this podcast is sponsored by Bombfell. And guys, when it comes to clothes, looking acceptable is pretty easy for us. We just go khakis and button-downs for work, suit and tie for wedding and funerals, and jeans and t-shirts for pretty much everything else. But what if you want to do more than look acceptable? What if you want to look good? What if you want to look, dare I say, great? Finding a great style that suits you and complements your coloring and shape is tough, and who can keep up with it? Well, Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. It's fully personalized. Every piece has been handpicked for you by your own stylist. Your stylist will email you their selections, after which you have about 2 days to make any changes or even cancel altogether. Then you receive the clothes. You have 7 days to tell them what you want to keep, and then you can send the rest back. You can receive clothes when you want and pause and cancel at any time. I signed up for Bombfell and was matched with Melissa as my stylist. After selecting styles that best represented me from dozens of options and inputting my sizes, Melissa set me up with a nice outfit consisting of pants, a long tee, and a pullover. And I liked them all, but I actually had a Henley in almost exactly the same color and style as the tee, so she substituted a cool kind of refugee from Zion in the Matrix kind of top. Just a few days later, I was trying on my new fit. I gotta say, not only did I enjoy the more dapper dork look that I had, but I received quite a few random compliments. Everything fit excellently and was comfortable enough for a full day at the studio, too. Bombfell has given us an exclusive deal for listeners of Bald Move, so you can get $25 off your first purchase. Just visit bombfell.com/GOT. That's BOMBFELL.com/GOT. No promo required. Just visit bombfell.com/GOT. That's Bombfell, open and close. I got feedback.
Okay.
You can send feedback into GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, or you can discuss on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, with your fellow fans. Let's dive right in. Evan N., it's bothering me that almost everyone I've heard, okay, this is the one email that I retained from last week, but I liked it. It's bothering me that almost everyone I heard talking about Gendry's three body count, or body count of three, is that they're accepting this as true. We know that Arya can always tell when someone's lying, so her line, "Don't you want to know what it feels like," directly after Gendry's body count claim, obviously lets us in that she suspects that he's lying.
Yeah,
and
but
that
she calls him out for lying at least twice in that scene.
So I guess I was.
And then she's satisfied with that final answer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she calls him out. She's, because he says, "Oh, you know, no one," or something. And, mm-hmm. and she's like, "Oh, bullshit."
Okay, well, hear this. He also said in, I think, season four that when he was in down in the dungeon with Davos, he confessed to him that, "Hey, you're me. You've never been with a woman, never even talked to a woman, really." I feel like that you're supposed to understand that Gendry's actually a virgin, except for being leeched by Melisandre.
How many women were out there on the sea while he was rowing? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, his non-human count is innumerable, because yeah. So
his grayscale covered.
He was very popular with the Merlings.
Yeah,
very popular with the Merlings.
Yes, very popular with Varys's people.
Very popular with Varys's people. Spoiler, Jesus.
Sorry. They won't know enough. The show only watchers will not know enough to get that reference.
But I thought I thought Evan had a good point that that makes it to where it's like the first time for both of them, it makes it even more special. After I thought about it, I didn't have much problems, but I thought that was interesting. Also, it kind of hints that Gendry is rejecting his father's path, who is like one of the most infamous womanizers of Westeros. So
yeah,
good points there, Evan.
But he does take up his weapon.
Moving on to Neil G. After learning of the Double D's connections with Always Sunny, are you surprised that the episode 3 wasn't called The Night King Cometh?
Yeah.
We could have used a dance number.
Oh,
we
could have
used a dance number here.
A song from Charlie would have gone a long way in this episode.
Kate says, "I'm a captain in the army, and I'm married to another captain in the army." That's a power couple right there. "And during this latest deployment, I spent almost the whole time listening to your podcast, sometimes more than once." Well, thank you, Kate. "We spent quite a bit of our time talking about the tactics in the Battle of Winterfell. The basic premises preparing for the defense are, one, the odds favor you even when the force ratios do not. The United States, for example, accepts a much smaller force ratio when they're on the defense versus when they're on the offense. And two, time is on your side as far as preparation goes. When you prepare for the defense, you develop an engagement area, which is where you plan to mass fire on the enemy in an unfavorable spot that you've provided with choke points and obstacles. You let the enemy come to you where he wants to fight, and you develop that spot to favor you. My overall point is, why wouldn't you plan to defend inside the castle walls? And why wouldn't you tie the dragons to the defense plan? They seem like they were doing whatever they wanted, but maybe Dany just lost her mind and broke with the plan. And other than spectacle and some brilliant filmmaking, why would you commit the mounted cavalry in a death charge when you're on the defense? You sacrifice the entire principle of the defensive advantage." I mean, if these things are obvious to an amateur, like myself, I can only imagine a professional officer is like really rolling their eyes here. So like, yeah, I got nothing for you, Captain.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most indefensible thing is simply the catapults being placed where they are.
Yeah.
I think the emailer is absolutely right. Like, Dany lost her shit. The Dothraki lost their shit. Like, this was not part of the plan.
Before she was nothing but a jumped up girl in a dress, she was Khaleesi. All right? So like, I think that these Dothraki dying like this really did wound her inside.
Yeah, for sure. And the Dothraki made a silly decision. She made a silly tactics breaking decision, but yeah.
But I thought they're
like, they told that story well.
Their tactics as planned always seem kind of dumb too. Like I get.
I mean, your two most powerful pieces are not on the board,
right?
You're kind of reserving them for some sort of Hail Mary defense here.
Like one of them maybe has to be dedicated to Bran Overwatch, but why did they plan on having them both? Like it seemed like it was a way overcautious and kind of an underestimation of the dead.
It's because they had this argument. They couldn't decide whether they needed a king afterward or a queen afterward. Right. And so they said, well, we'll both just stay.
Oh my God. Wouldn't that be it? If it's like, if Dany's like, you just got to stay next to me. Cause like, you know, if you survive,
I'm super important. I'm going to be the queen after all this is over. We can't lose me. And John says, well, I'm the rightful king after this is over. So we can't lose me.
Yeah. David C. says, "I feel extremely bummed as a fan. I feel the failure of this episode has a lot to do with the Double D's not having the books in hand. The episode feels a lot how How I Met Your Mother ended, where it could be completely ruined for a fan on a rewatch. Every time Ned talks about winter coming, who cares, bro? We just got to stick him with the pointy end and we'll be fine forever. I've been saying for a long time that I don't think the Double D signed up to write Game of Thrones fan fiction. And they are exactly as bummed as you and I are that none of these books came out. And maybe these books can't ever come out because it just... there's not enough time in a human lifetime to take all these plot points that Martin has gardened up and prune them into a satisfying ending. I don't know. The other thing that really sucks is I don't think we're getting much, if any, of Martin's bullet points, because the Double D's have never been shy about calling that out before. Like, oh, Hodor dying and holding the door. That was one of the bullet points that blew us away from Martin. Like, if this was like checking boxes that Martin was having him check, they would be talking about that, and they're not. There's like 40-minute long making these episodes where they're talking about why they're doing the things they're doing, and they're not saying that it's always about like, we wanted the audience to feel this way. We wanted the audience to feel this way. It's not about like hitting this particular point and getting things into any kind of final shape. So it's doubly frustrating because I don't think we're even getting any glimpse into what Martin actually had as an ending. Be interesting to see what he says when all this is said and done.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, oh, that's pretty close, or like, oh, way off, or nothing in common at all, or...
You know what I wish we could have seen over the course of the last few seasons?
What's that?
George Martin doing reaction YouTube videos to Game of Thrones. That would have been outstanding.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Okay, moving on to Nick M. Why is everyone acting like Melisandre is the most valuable person? She literally did nothing of importance. Bringing back her quote to Arya about shutting blue eyes shatters Melisandre's story, in my opinion. If she saw this 4 or 5 years ago, why did she continue to serve and believe Stannis was Azor Ahai? Why did she resurrect Jon and believe that he was Azor Ahai? I like her character as the unsure prophet serving a god out of faith, but now she just knows it's Arya and we get no explanation as to why or how.
So I think you're trying to make two separate points here.
Okay.
One is that this prophecy kind of makes everything else she does pointless throughout the course of these last few seasons. I don't know that you're wrong about that necessarily. I do take a little umbrage at the idea that she does nothing in this battle, because she ultimately gives Arya the inspiration to go kill the Night King.
The pep talk, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's important.
But that was the plan, to kill the Night King.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, like, it's kind of like...
Arguably, she's as important, if not more important, than the person who actually killed the Night King.
Uh-huh.
Certainly as important. Because I don't think Arya has the idea to go try and kill the Night King if she isn't in this room with Melisandre at that point.
I wish we knew, because, like, I think they could have solved this with a bit of dialogue about, like, you know, where have you been? I've been in Volantis, consulting with my god and my brothers and sisters, and I've come... Like, she could play, like, a Doctor Strange kind of role, you know? Like she's foreseen the future, and she knows there's one, but if she says anything, it might wreck the divine plan.
Right, she's Doctor Stranging it, yeah.
Yeah, and
did you say Doctor Strange or Doctor...
Who? No, Doctor Strange. I hope I said Doctor Strange. Did I say Doctor Strange Love?
I can't remember.
She's like Doctor Strange. She's just frantically riding a rocket into the ground.
I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Say I heard Doctor Strangelove.
Okay.
You said Doctor Strange.
I probably said Doctor Strangelove because that sounds like a stupid thing I do. But I think that Melisandre has been wrong about a lot of her prophecies, but her prophecies are always right on. It's just she's wrong about how they're interpreted. So, like, I think this is just the latest thing. Is like, she gave an accurate prophecy, but now that she's been to Volantis, and I imagine that she went back there to just confer with her god and her people and try to get a last little bit, and now she sees with the clarity. You know, she's got a certain clarity that she's coming back with, and she knows she's going to die. But did they do a good enough job telling that story? No, I think they could have done a much better job. It's all there. I think those parts can be stitched together, but like it's a little half-baked, like a lot of the last few seasons have been in the plotting. Peyton, I was wondering, am I the only one who was disappointed with Jon riding a dragon for most of the Battle of Winterfell? I think back to all the iconic scenes of the Battle of the Bastards and other fight scenes we've seen Jon in, and he's always been down in the thick of it with his men. I found Jon's more exciting scenes to be after he was thrown off the dragon and actually started to have to fight on the ground. Cosine.
Yeah, but that was Jon Snow. Jon Snow gets down on the ground and he does hand-to-hand combat. Aegon Targaryen does not do that shit. Mm. Aegon Targaryen stands back, lets his armies fight, rides his dragon. That's the difference here, is now he's a king.
I don't think Aegon the Conqueror Targaryen just spent battles hanging on for dear life to the back of his dragon. That's the problem, is that nothing felt like... It didn't feel like these dragons were being piloted competently.
And or at all.
Or at all. That's fine for Dany, I guess. But for... Or no, that's fine for Jon, because he doesn't... He just started riding dragons last week. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's you know... Like I said, that first week, like I thought that Jon riding the dragon for the first time would be a big moment, and it wasn't. I should, like, to me, that was the indicative of, like, there's not going to be a lot of this deep kind of payoffs, you know? Like, that's that he's riding a dragon. He doesn't even know he's a Targaryen yet, so how could he be any meaning? But he's riding a dragon that's named after his actual fucking father. He's got this weird affinity for it. Like, that should have been a real fucking moment. And
or then, there should have had a second moment.
Yeah.
Right. Like once he knows that information,
yeah,
then his perspective is entirely changed when he comes back to ride the dragon.
So first time he does, he's kind of a fuck up. But then when he finds out that you actually are a Targaryen and you're born to this, and this dragon,
and he has a connection with this
dragon. Like, yes, you're right. That'd be good storytelling. So moving on to Alex F. I'm assuming Dany rushing into the battle despite protests and plans otherwise is meant to mirror Jon at the Battle of Bastards, where he did the same thing. But it's a good point. But I'm just so lost as why Jon and Dany didn't fly in immediately when it was planned to be that way, roasting as many thousands of whites as possible. Even setting multiple lines of fire to make it harder for the dead to keep moving forward. I understand the strategy in Game of Thrones is generally lacking, and clearly this is no exception, but that one's tough to understand. I guess you could say the Stark ancestral castle name was quite accurate, though. It's where Winter fell. Yeah, it's one of the big theories is that that's how it got its name in the first place. It's like the site of where the Night King was broken the first time. But... I mean, yeah, I think it's super wacky to have your most powerful weapons and don't have a plan to use them other than when the big bad comes in to kill him.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't have worked, it turns out, anyway.
That's true.
Brody W., after this week's episode, Jorah and the Dothraki joined Viserion on the list of deaths Dany has had to suffer fighting Jon's battles. With her comments to Sansa about Jon manipulating her into this fight, and now with one of her children... her closest advisor and all that she had left of Drogo's memory in all gone thanks to Jon's war. Do you think this may be the catalyst for her to turn? Is there even time to play out a Mad Queen Dany storyline?
I mean, they've got to deal with this I'm the queen, you're the king thing.
And they have 5 episodes worth of screen time left, essentially.
It's 4.5 to 5 episodes.
And they pick it up, Brody. This is where they're going to pick it up because you're right. Like, but the thing is like... they can do that, but it won't make her a sympathetic or likable villain because she saw the stakes. She saw how desperate this was and how touch and go. Like, who the fuck says, you know what? None of these sacrifices were worth it after this battle.
Yeah.
The one other thing that kind of bothers me is this only happened in the North and it largely was fought with Northern combatants or foreign combatants that didn't survive. What if people just deny this was ever a thing? What if Cersei says there was no, like, what if the Citadel's like, there's no army to dead? Come on, you fucking, you Northerners just starved up in this winter and you don't want to admit that you were ill-prepared. You went on an ill-advised war against the rightful king and you starved your people and now you're trying to blame it on this Night King. Like, couldn't they do that and get away with it? Especially if there's like 500 people walking away from this battle?
Yeah, I've always wondered about how trust works in that society, right? Because trust is a fickle and delicate thing often. And when you don't have the means that we have today to prove something, like if you can't take a photo of something, if you can't take a video of something, and even that's coming into question nowadays, but what do you have to prove it? You essentially have honor and you have loyalty and you have like the virtuous qualities that we think of people having, that kind of it's all just on the honor system in a lot of cases. And I think for people who would take advantage of that, it's very easy to do so. And Cersei is certainly that kind of person. I don't think it's a very satisfying way to go with the end of this story.
No.
I'll say I'll be pretty bummed if she just, like, defines her own truth.
Yeah.
And says this shit never happened, fake news, keep going, Westeros, we got this.
Right.
And just nobody believes it. I'll be just hugely disappointed, but we'll see.
Daniel T, Tyrion's statement from episode 1 of season 8 about Daenerys' army being the greatest army the world has ever seen was unbelievably evident during this battle. What Westerosi army slash fighting force would be willing to charge head on at the Army of Dead as the Dothraki did, or be able to withstand the onslaught of the charging Army of the Dead in pure darkness as the Unsullied did without shitting themselves and turning tail? Dario's point from season 5 that a man who has no fear doesn't know how to hide made perfect sense in describing the flaws of the Unsullied in that scenario. But in this situation, only men without fear could keep the living alive long enough to be able to retreat and make a final stand amongst inside the castle. Every time Grey Worm yelled out commands during this episode and the Unsullied shifted formation in unison, I got chills.
Yeah.
I do too, and I wanna my headcanon is that, like, yes, they are trained to not feel fear, but a part of that is them drinking that, like, drugged cocktail that they have to kind of keep them in that state. I think that, at least in my headcanon, that they've all developed individual personalities and, like, wants and desires, and it's not that they don't feel fear anymore. They're not, like, they're not fearful. It's just that they believe in their cause, which makes it even more impressive.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I thought... I thought it was kind of goofy, the lockstep way they kind of moved, but like when they're covering the retreat and it was like this elegant, like, back and inward step and the center column was continually collapsing and going through it's like, god damn, that was just really cool. And it's hard not to be moved about these, because like if they were routed, everyone dies at several points. And yeah, I think they also told the story of like several hundred of them just being sacrificed for the greater good. And the egregious thing is they just told that part of the story poorly, in my opinion. But no, I agree with you there, Daniel. Moving on to Devin H. I think one of the most standout elements this episode that brought it all together for me was Jawadi's score. It was tense when it needed to be, but what I appreciated most was it was understated or even absent for entire chunks. I feel like they underplayed or silent scoring actually made the scenes more eerie and tense than if the entire runtime had been fully scored with dramatic music. On top of that, I really dug into the heavy bass droning synth beat that was used whenever we saw Winterfell being utterly overwhelmed. It was such a different style from everything that we've ever heard on the show. Yeah, I agree. I thought, I can't remember the woman's name, but we interviewed the sound designer at the last Con of Thrones.
Was it Paula?
Paula, yeah. Paula Wright? Anyway,
I can't remember her last name.
One of the things I thought was fascinating is how they decide doing that, because it's usually a very late, like, you know, they've got score, they got sound design, and it's like the director and the showrunner is like arguing like how loud it should be. Should you drop, like, you know, she said many times that she did sound design for an entire scene and they drop it all and just play music. And that's kind of like, you know. Yeah, like,
yeah, I think she specifically referenced Battle of the Bastards.
Yes.
As one of those.
Because, like,
maybe?
You know, they did, like, one of those cavalry charges where it's, like, yeah. Jon standing alone, and they did all the Foley and the armor clanking and the hoofs galloping, and then it, like, that was, like, blanked out for a minute.
That takes so much time.
But I think it goes both ways, and it's like, you know, she said at the end of the day that, like, you got to serve the art. You can't be, you know, territorial about your work. So I think everyone here seems like they're incredibly generous about it doesn't, like if my little piece gets obscured, then, because I also think about, like, some of these FX guys that did, like, beautiful fucking modeling work on the dragon fight, and most of the audience didn't appreciate it to the extent that they should have.
The animation team that worked on the dragons?
Yeah.
And then to have this other fucker over in background fill it with clouds of smoke and winter.
Right.
Like, what the fuck, I worked on this for months.
And also, this is shit that I don't think has ever been on film before. I can't think of dragon-on-dragon aerial combat. The closest I can think of is, like, when the eagles came to kick the ass of the fell beast that the Nazgul rode at the end of Return of the King. Like, you had, like, 3 seconds of, like, aerial combat versus something that looked like a dragon, but, like...
I've seen dragon on helicopter battles.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. We had that with
a little movie called Reign of Fire.
You can enjoy it tomorrow on the Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy. But yeah, like this shit that like I was like when I was reading Fire and Blood last year, and there's like quite a few descriptions of these aerial combats of like what like a much larger dragon can do to a smaller dragon, and like getting their wings ripped off in midair, and just the violent collisions. And like I saw that was like all on the screen. Well, I saw that a day and a half later when some Redditor brightened it up 4,000% and slowed it down. But like that. Uh-huh. But that just goes to show you that, like, I'm sure there was probably a lot of... I imagine there's a lot of CGI people, like, watching that, the final render, thinking, interesting decision.
Yeah.
Interesting decision to light it in this way. But what are you going to do? Oh, finally, Devin says, also, I never thought about it till this episode, but I'm officially shipping Sansa and Tyrion now.
Okay. How could you never think about that before?
We talk about it every fucking season, and I always say, like, hey... If that's how Sansa wants it, like, because I think that Tyrion has a lot of cool qualities that could make a person like Sansa happy. Mm-hmm. But, like, if Sansa doesn't want it, then fuck Tyrion. Because Sansa gets what Sansa wants after all the shit she's been through.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like, right. If either party in a relationship does not want the relationship, it shouldn't go forward.
Yeah.
But I'm on board with you.
I'm not saying like mere consent. I don't want her to settle for Tyrion. Like if she's got a shot at like someone her age, from her part of the world, that she finds more attractive, like she deserves whatever she
wants. I can't think of who the hell that would be.
Pa. No, you're right.
Like there's literally nobody else who has any kind of connection to Sansa.
Gendry.
That would be.
She swoops in and steals Arya's boy. How fucking sister can you get?
One final mashed potato to the face on Arya. I know it was the other way around, but
should have taken those needlepoint lessons seriously, Arya. How can you expect to get a man like Gendry with no needlepoint? Horse face. That was the insult she always threw at him. He didn't want to. He told me himself he didn't want to. You were okay, but you're too horse facey, Arya. Horse face, Arya. Arya with the horse face. Okay. Jack A, got my mean girls out of me. Now that Arya is one of the most important kills in Westerosi history, will she be given a new dope alias title, such as Jaime being called the King Slayer? Does that mean Arya could be possibly called the Night Slayer? Nightsbane? Nightsbane.
Yeah.
Bane of Winter. Winter's Bane.
Mm-hmm.
Guardian of Winterfell. Lady Protector of Winterfell.
How about Sneak King?
Sneak King. Sneak King. Yeah, I like it.
Sneak King.
See. Morgan T. I want to reflect on some feedback I sent in quite a bit ago. It turned out more relevant than I could have ever imagined, and he quoted some feedback that he submitted for episode 704, The Spoils of War. I have some thoughts regarding Bran and his interaction with Littlefinger, namely when he's given the dagger and he asks Littlefinger, do you know who this belonged to? Littlefinger took it to mean that he knew who had tried to have Bran assassinated, but I took it to mean he was asking about who it belonged to, as in its first owner. The main thing that kept me from Littlefinger's line of thinking was the drawing of this exact dagger that Sam glossed over in the Citadel earlier that season, in season 7. Hmm. I'm not sure the role the dagger will play, if any, but the fact that it has a dragonbone handle paired with the fact that it's a Valyrian steel blade, to me, points to Targaryen ownership. Your thoughts?
Interesting.
Here again, this could entirely be something that was going to be a bigger deal in the books, and they just didn't pay it off. Because you're right, I remember a lot of speculation about that scene, that dragon and like that thing. So like it did turn out to be as important as a thing can be, but you can't draw a line between that evidence and its importance, right?
And not currently, certainly. Right.
Like Sam would have to say something about like, oh, that dagger,
or Bran,
or somebody. Somebody. I mean, maybe, because that's the other thing. It's like there is a possibility that in the wrap up from this episode that we're going to get in next time, they're going to be talking about this, that there will be some lore elements filled in, or there will be some things that like make a little bit more sense. But unfortunately, all that shit can only be given half credit, because explaining things that make sense after the fact is never as good as having the audience know what the fuck is going on the first time.
Yeah.
And be anticipating things, you know? Ashley R. After episode 3, I am worried that we have some unanswered questions regarding the Night King now that he's dead. What were all of his patterns about? If we're not going to learn anything more about the motives of him, are we never going to know why he arranged the dead bodies and patterns? Also, I still don't really get the whole three-eyed raven stuff. Why did Bran have to become the three-eyed raven? I thought he'd had some massive role to play, or do you think that comes later?
This is not something that hugely bothers me personally, but I completely understand the people who it does. If you were looking for something larger, sort of as was promised, out of the Night King and the forces of the dead, you just didn't get it.
The funniest take I saw was someone on Reddit like arranged all the different spiral patterns that we've seen into a collage, and it said, who knew that this is the double D's trying to subtly tell us that all your theories will be flushed down the toilet bowl about what all this means.
No, that's got to be disappointing if you were hoping for something more.
I mean, Dan and Dave said, David said in the Blu-ray commentary of season one, that the whole reason they had the White Walkers do patterns is so you would know that they were intelligent and they were not like some bestial force or some kind of like subhuman intelligence. That these were people with a culture and language.
But that's all they did with it.
Right. Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. We didn't actually get any insight into what that culture looks like.
And when it kept paying off and kept paying off, like it did feel like they were going with something. And the fact a lot of people point out this looked like the Targaryens' like sigil. But none of that went everywhere. About Bran at the Iron... The problem with wanting something to pay off later is the Three-Eyed Crow, like, if he was going to do anything cool, you would think it would be for this battle. Mm-hmm. Like, the Three-Eyed Raven is more concerned with this than he would be some petty political strife down south. So, yeah. I mean, So the third of the people that are over the moon in this episode, I confess that I don't understand you any more than I understand the people that are just like barking at the moon, angry about Arya being the princess that was promised, right? Like, you're not even a little bit disappointed that Bran rolls his eyes back in his head for an hour of this episode and then rolls him back out to do nothing, to literally do nothing.
Yeah, seemingly.
Like, that's how you expected in your wildest dreams, or like, wow, I didn't see Bran warging and doing nothing. Amazing. Like, there's a little disconnect here, probably at both extremes, because, you know, what are you going to do if you got you're like me, you got 8+ years of your life invested in this thing. It's tough to hate, it's tough to love, but it'll be interesting to see how this ages, and it's going to be probably depend a lot on how the rest of the series goes.
Right. I'm still holding that candle of hope for the rest of this series. I think there's still a possibility that they really stick the landing here. But like I said, every little bit that I see that doesn't push it toward that scares me.
Yeah. And like it was also like I remember that this is like, I don't know what, the 10th, 12th time we've covered a final season of a beloved show. And there's always like some point in the season where people are wanting to, you know, bail, like pull the ripcord and like, oh God, there's no fucking way. It's shit because like, and it comes down to a lot of like people get an idea of how things should go. Mm-hmm. And there's a disappointment that you weren't clever enough to figure it out. I think that's selling this discontent a little short, but you're right. Like, I mean, the Night King, he was built up to be this apocalyptic threat, but 90%, 95% of the series has been about the people and their connection and their loyalties and their divided loyalties and their politicking and all that kind of stuff. So if they hit that and the Night King just was, you know, a stressor on the heroes that made them do certain, put them in certain weakened positions, then it can still work. It can still work. So let's hope they get it together. Scott V, as the Night King walked up to Bran, it reminded me of Gus Fring confronting Uncle Tio, quote-unquote, in Breaking Bad. Maybe it was the wheelchair, but I kept thinking Bran was going to pull some kind of sacrifice to take them both out. I kind of thought that was his plan all along, but no, the Three-Eyed Raven's plan was to just sit by a tree.
Stare.
To me, thematically, what is the point of Bran's story? I've watched this kid for 8 seasons. When he learned of Hodor's destiny and why it happened, I was simply stunned. I couldn't wait to see how Bran's journey would justify Hodor's sacrifice. What I got was, hey, I'm going to sit by this tree. Could you guys maybe start the bad guy on fire or something? Help me understand it because I do not get it.
I can't help you understand it because the show didn't help us understand it.
Yep.
Maybe they will. Maybe there'll be something that Bran can say to make this all make sense, but the show did not give us enough context to understand exactly why Bran was important.
Yeah, like I have to this point not compared what actually happened to some of the theories of what was going to happen. Because if I did that, unfortunately, none of this comes away looking flattering. Night King, I think of how little the Night King mattered and how he went out. Like, I would kind of preferred him to go to the King's Landing and fuck shit up. You know, there's so many people have been thinking of things that would have been satisfying and cool, and to see them, like, people are paid a lot of money to sweat these details and spend, like, they delayed this thing a year and a half so they could get all this stuff right, and this is all right, we're closing up on end here. Hans W has a great question. The Night King is obviously immune to Dragonfire, but meets his ultimate demise by Valyrian steel. Popular theory goes that Valyrian steel gets its magical properties by being forged in Dragonfire. This has got to be proved false, right? So what's the deal with Valyrian steel?
I don't know that it has to be proved false.
Well, if Dragonfire doesn't kill him, metal smelted by Dragonfire, why would that kill him?
Why wouldn't it? Do we know the properties of metal smelted by Dragonfire? Like,
no, we don't.
It might change it chemically somehow, whereas the chemical of, like...
Yeah. I thought it was total bullshit that dragon had no effect on him. I just thought that was complete bullshit.
Okay. I didn't. I mean, I don't know why we would expect it to.
Because it seems like they're, like I said, like, would a normal fire set the Night King on fire? Is he just too cool?
I mean, I think the definitive answer is no.
He just has a whole pack of five gum. He's chewing it full time. And
I don't
so
think
frosty.
Fire works on any of the White Walkers.
He's chewing a whole pack.
We've seen it not work.
Chewing a whole pack of five gum while simultaneously cracking open an entire six pack of Coors Light. He's got the Silver Bullet Express. Like, he is immune to all sources of fire and heat.
I think that's true.
Yeah, and Danny's fireproof too. Like, they could have drawn a fire and ice comedy, like a comparison, but that they chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess. Like I said, I can spin a bunch of fan theories about why it might work, but yeah. Bottom line, Hans, we are not going to get a satisfying answer about the why Dragon Glass or Dragon Steel affects.
No,
the Night
it
King.
Just does. It's magic.
It just does. Katie, as you remember, we saw the creation of the Night King a few seasons back when the Children of the Forest stuck a shard of Dragon Glass into one of the men. I know people are looking for some deeper purpose behind the Night King, but for me, this explanation is satisfying enough. In a war against the First Men, the Children were basically being wiped out and created White Walkers as a nuclear option.
Mm-hmm.
A smart weapon was created to hunt down humans to extinction, but despite the fall of the Children of the Forest, the Night King was still programmed by magic to do one thing, kill humans, and that's what he's been doing ever since. I'm not bitching about the Night King not having a better backstory or better motivation for... I'm not actually bitching about anything that happened to the Night King, to be honest, other than maybe he's immune to Dragonfire. There was no... Like, the broad strokes of this are fine. It's just how little care I think they took to get from point A to point B and, you know, over 90 minutes that I think led to everything being kind of... And the lack of payoff for... Like, they ultimately paid the shit out of all of Arya's stuff, but, like... So, like... Could John have killed that fucking dragon with his fucking Valyrian steel that he didn't do anything but kill whites with? That giant psychic blow to the Night King staggers him somewhat to loosen him up for Arya or something? Because ultimately, no one mattered except for Arya.
Yeah, and Melisandre.
Okay. That's a lot of credit for a pep talk there.
I mean, pep talks are important. Pep talks win games.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Ken C wants to know if the death of the Night King is winter no longer coming. Will it progressively get warmer? The snow-covered fields around Winterfell turn into grassy meadows, Jim?
I assume so, yeah. Winter is no longer a thing, right?
Or at least the unnatural seasons of it. I assume.
Yeah.
So, how would they even pay that off? I don't know. Like, I guess if everything's dripping and warming up, then that would do it next episode. Kind of like when Shireen died or got burnt to death.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Tom C, the Night King spreads his power through touch. Could he have transferred something to Arya as he died? Because he was holding her neck after all. It's It's also been theorized that the Night King was a Stark. If so, would it make sense for him to spread it to another Stark, such as Arya?
I really doubt it. I mean, if everything associated, everything the Night King's ever touched has disintegrated at this point, I don't think he's got some special, like, consciousness he can put in Arya or anything.
Yeah. And like I said, unless killing the Night King is the last thing you want to do because someone's got to take his place, and there's still maybe some, like, big cosmic world-building things they could pull out in the last episode.
Boy, that'd make Bran look real stupid.
Right, yeah. Well, this has never happened before. You can't blame me.
Right.
Ryan, probably a long shot, but is it possible the Night King's face is in Arya's catalog now? I can't. I mean, he burst into snow powder.
Yeah.
I think you need, like, I don't know. With as much time as we spent with Arya in the House of Black and White, still couldn't tell you exactly how they make the masks and how they apply it and how
but
it
But I
works.
Think they're physical masks.
It does seem like
Sansa
they're physical masks.
Sansa pulls a bunch out of the bag of Arya's bag.
Yeah. That's where, like, everybody's saying that Arya could just wear a face of a White Walker. I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can kill
it. Yeah, because if you kill it, it will disintegrate.
They burst into snow, and then there's nothing skin. And if you skin its face, like, what did that even mean? Like, you
right.
know, can you do
Especially
that?
Especially when it's mostly a skeleton at that point.
Right. So
that's where it's skull.
Jamie M. Although Theon definitely redeemed himself in the end, if I were Mira Reed, I would be so pissed off that Theon got a much nicer, more sincere thank you. Good news for Sansa. She doesn't have to worry about how to feed the world's largest army anymore.
That's true. They have a ton of food now.
They got so much food. They got so much food. Plus all the meat, the fresh meat on the battlefield. I mean, if you get really desperate. I know those northerners, they do get a little cannibalistic when the depth of winter sets in. But no, I think that, like, Bran's also getting a little bit better of a handle on the three-eyed raven business. I think if Mira was to leave after this battle, she would get a little something. It would be a little bit better of a human
interface.
It
wouldn't be a full thank you. It would be a thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't be as creepy and weird. And David's email will be the last email of the podcast. Of course, this is not the last podcast we're doing this week. Now, is it, Jim?
No.
We have a little bit of a cliffhanger here that we will resolve on Friday, where we get on our spoiler edition of the podcast and we can talk even more about some of the deep things in the book that probably won't matter on the show. And we'll see, like, what, because the thing is, like, I've spent a lot of time making sure that, like, my criticisms of this episode were at least, you know, I could substantiate and, like, give good reasons for. I haven't really delved into, like, how pissed off the r/ the Song of Ice and Fire are that, like, all these prophecies probably aren't going to mean anything, or maybe they could be true from a different perspective, or maybe they could be true for the King's Landing stuff.
If, like, you're a book reader, I feel like you have more legitimate complaints than just a show watcher.
Yeah, and I've tried to really just keep it to show watching at this point, so, like, I'm sure there'll be lots of more to talk about on Friday. Please get that into GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, and again, if you want to talk, if you want to cry on each other's shoulders about it, we have a legion of fans in our forum. forums.baldmove.com. And that's it. Again, we'll be back for the spoiler edition, and of course we've got the super serious fan fest fantasy Reign of Fire edition. Look out for the youngest King Joffrey lurking in the margins of this film. Hope you guys enjoy that, and we'll be back this weekend to do it all over again with the instant talk and instant take after the supersized edition, another supersized edition of Game of Thrones episode 71. We'll see you then. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.